Good morning, everyone. If you are joining us in chambers or remotely, you have joined the Miami Beach Finance and Economic Resiliency Committee meeting of February 17th. And Rafael, can you let everyone know how they could join remotely if they wish to do so?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. Today's meeting of the Finance and Economic Resiliency Committee has been scheduled in a hybrid format with a quorum of the committee physically present and staff and members of the public appearing either in person or virtually via Zoom. In order to participate in today's meeting virtually, members of the public may dial 1-888-475-4499 and enter the webinar ID, which is 863-6059-5462#. Or you could log into the Zoom app and enter the webinar ID, which again is 863-6059-5462#. Any individual wishing to speak on an item must click the raise hand icon if you're using the Zoom app or dial *9 if you're participating by phone.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you, sir. Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Commissioner Arriola is also joining us remotely until he's on the way in. He'll be here in a few minutes. So we'll start with item number one. And by the way, Kathy, we have a couple of deferrals for you.
Yes, Commissioner, if I may. Item six has been deferred. We have a correction on the agenda titles, which shows item four as co-sponsored by Mayor Gelber, and it should show as co-sponsored by Vice Mayor Minor. And in the future items, to be heard at a later date, item 24 has been withdrawn.
Item 24 has been withdrawn.
Yes, by Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez.
Okay. Perfect. And then just for everyone who may be waiting, we have a couple of time certains. We'll be hearing item 2 and 3, which is on the waste hauler at 10:30 a.m. this morning. So if you're here for that, you've got plenty of time to go get a coffee. And on item 12, which is on the homeless trust fund, and I think that is actually 11 and 12. Both of those items we'll be hearing at 11:30 a.m. So, again, if you're here for that, you can take a nice coffee break. And with that, we will get started. Let's call up item number one. This is your item,
yes.
Vice Chair.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This item is a discussion on the feasibility to potentially implement a local hiring preference for our city employees. And I understand it's a challenging process. It's not the easiest policy to implement. But I do feel that there is value added when our workforce lives close to where they're serving the public. They walk in the shoes of the residents and the taxpayers of the city, and they encounter the same challenges. And also, their productivity. If you live closer to your job, typically your output is usually better, and your pride and your work is usually better. Notwithstanding that, we have an amazing workforce that work hard for the residents of this city every single day, and we're so grateful to them. But I would like to see how in the future, moving forward, what type of hiring preferences we could establish that would give some sort of preference to either residents of our city or people who live in closer proximity to our city. And I know the city attorney's office has been researching this with our HR director. And if you allow me, Mr. Chair, I'd like to recognize our deputy
city attorney. Go ahead, Robbie, recognize.
Thank you, Commissioners. Good morning.
Is the microphone on? Just check.
It is on. Sorry, let me get a little bit closer. Usually I'm too loud on here, but so this is the question is whether we can have a local hiring preference for employees to give a preference or a leg up on people who apply who live in the city of Miami Beach. And the answer from legal is that yes, you can do that. Unless there is some reason that it would make it discriminatory to do so. And unfortunately, there is a complication with our particular racial demographic in that we have a much lower percentage of black people living in the city of Miami Beach than in, say, for example, Miami-Dade County or the state of Florida. Our percentage is about 4% black. Both the county and the state are around 17% black. I will say that our workforce, we are well represented by diverse communities, including with black people who make up 22.3% of our percent of our current workforce. So from a legal point of view, the general answer is yes. Hiring preferences for locals has been approved by the courts. We do have this additional rub that we have a lower percentage of black people living here, so we may need to, if you decided to make this policy choice, we may need to do something to ameliorate that. And we've spoken with the sponsor with perhaps having a wider swath of area that we would consider residents, which might include the city of Miami Beach and the city of Miami, for example, or city of Miami Beach and Miami-Dade County, or an area X number of miles from Miami Beach would qualify. So it would bring in enough diverse populations that it would make it no disparate impact to have that policy. So that's the legal lay of the land. Now, on a policy matter, whether you want to do it, whether the administration wants to do it, I'll defer to them to speak on that. But on the legal landscape, that's it.
And Mr. Chair, one of the things that's not lost in me is how difficult it is right now for our city to recruit employees. We have vacancies in our city, but it's not always easy to fill those vacancies. And so one of the things, if we do consider any policy of this nature, is under equal qualifications, anything be under equal qualifications, where we perhaps give some sort of preference to the individual that is within closer proximity to the city. I see our city manager is here, and I don't know if you allow me to recognize her. I don't know.
Good morning, Ms. Hudak. How are you? You're recognized. Do you have any thoughts about this?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I was here trying to do something else, and I listened to the conversation. I thought it was important for me to stay and really, for the record, be very clear about my commitment, my personal commitment to obviously hiring, from our resident pool to the extent that that's possible. And I think that's clearly evidenced by the fact that I've recommended to all of you for consideration next week the hiring of a CFO who is, in fact, a resident of the city of Miami Beach. Sitting right next to me is our interim CFO, also a resident of Miami Beach. So certainly that is a personal and professional commitment of my administration. I think it is important for me as your city manager to highlight the challenges that we face in hiring. And we're not unlike the rest of the country. I mean, this isn't something that's happening uniquely in Miami Beach or even uniquely in this community, but we struggle to fill our professional vacancies, in particular in the categories of engineers, financial people, and, even hiring budget analysts. We do have, and we do experience tremendous turnover in our city for a multitude of reasons. And post-COVID, we've experienced all of the things that, most of the country has experienced. We do have a younger workforce overall that wants to work from home, and that is not a flexibility that we have as government. And so there are a lot of complicating factors in, having a qualified workforce, and there are a lot of challenges. And so I would only ask you to consider that, and I want you and obviously Commissioner Fernandez to know of my personal commitment to making sure that all things being equal, all things being that we have a top-notch qualified candidate for whatever position in this city, that we are committed to hiring from the residents of this city.
So do we know, when we do hiring, where our employees are coming from? Is it mostly Miami-Dade County as a whole, including Miami Beach, or obviously the CFO that's just being hired is, as you said, a resident of Miami Beach? But good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
You're recognized. What do you think?
Thank you, Marla Elpis, our Human Resources Director. To answer your question, Chair, yes, the majority of our employees are residents of the county.
Okay, great. Commissioner Areola says he's got his hand up. Can you bring him in and let's recognize him?
Yeah, good morning. I'm pulling in. Thank you, Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. And Madam City Manager, listening to your comments, and we've discussed this before, and yeah, I feel your frustration and, you know, the challenge of hiring qualified, you know, labor in this market, you know, and finding appropriate wages. You know, might it be worth exploring for us to consider having a new tier of government employee, ones that would not be eligible for our generous pension programs and other benefits, and be more, you know, sort of private market oriented, where we don't have defined benefit programs? We'll pay a higher salary, but, you know, you're not going to get the pensions. And then also, you know, have a performance review process where, like in the private sector, you either deliver or you're out, unlike the government where you just kind of get shuffled around, you know, or you're limited by your ability to fire and discipline because of, you know, various, you know, policies that we have as part of our civil code. If there's an appetite for that, I would sponsor exploring that because it will address, you know, this wage issue I keep hearing about. You know, we could pay $300,000 for an engineer or more, but not have that pension obligation.
We have discussed that, Commissioner, at length internally, and it's certainly something we can continue. There is an interesting complication here, which, again, you know, predates many of us. This city, for whatever reason, made a decision many, many years ago not to contribute to Social Security. And as part of that decision, there was a commitment made to provide a certain level of pension protection. So there's a lot of legal intricacies associated with not providing that we can certainly highlight and explore. And we've talked a lot about offering that and even offering that on a contractual basis. And we actually have tried to do that in Public Works and in CIP because it's such an issue. But we can certainly continue exploring that. I will tell you that, again, you know, we have 5 collective bargaining agreements that we're bound by that also have limitations in terms of what we can and cannot do.
Yeah,
but all that aside, I want to explore trying to do this because to address the issue you're raising, we have to fix it. If we can't get qualified workers because of pay, then let's pay what we have to pay. But, you know, let's compare apples to apples what these folks would be making in the private sector on a salary basis. They certainly don't enjoy our generous pension obligations. And we would take the burden away from, you know, future generations of Miami Beach taxpayers, you know, get the workers we need now at the appropriate salary levels, but not burden, you know, future generations with these, you know, very, very generous pension obligations. Because, you know, I hear this thing about the salary disparity, and yeah, it's kind of true, but I'm not sure that, you know, we fully reflect, you know, how good people will have it when they retire from our city. They don't get that in the private sector. That's just a fact.
I think there was an item a year or two ago, something similar to this, but I don't know that. Commissioner Areola, do you want to put a referral on the 22nd and then send it to finance, and then we can certainly have staff look at that issue?
I will. I'm not sure, you know, I'll be able to get on the agenda unless we vote for it because of the our time limitation, but I'll try, and if, 4 or 5 of us want to hear it and refer to finance, then we'll hear it.
Yeah, so you're running up against the 4-day rule, but I certainly wouldn't oppose. I don't oppose referrals, so I would encourage you to do that, and let's get it referred to finance, and then I think we should look at the issue and see if there's a way to do that. As the manager mentioned, the city made a decision years ago to opt out of Social Security, so if you did not have someone participating in the pension, then I don't know legally if we can even collect Social Security from them if they're an employee of the city, because I think that's a citywide. But that's something that we could explore and just look at it. But it's a bigger question than today. But Commissioner, on the item before us, What's your dream? Do you want to have some additional conversation about this? I mean, my concern is that we need to cast the biggest net to get the most talent. If you had two qualified people that were equally qualified, and one's Miami Beach and one is not, there's nothing that would prohibit us from giving the job to the, you know, Miami Beach resident, right?
No, that wouldn't be a problem now. And under the proposed rule, as it's been explained to me, that would be the standard. If you had two equally qualified apples-to-apples candidates and there was no other differentiation between them, and one was a resident and one was not, you would have the option of going with the resident.
But that hasn't been memorialized anywhere in terms of that's not in any ordinance or resolution that we
correct,
have before.
Correct.
So is that what you'd like to do? Or what
sure. I would love for the city attorney's office, together with the city administration, to come back to the committee with an actual proposal, a policy recommendation that we can consider at the next meeting that we can then send back to commission on this. And if I may, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Arriola, thank you for what you've brought up. The majority of our biggest generation right now in our workforce are millennials. I think it represents 35% of our workforce in the city of Miami Beach. I think they're cost burdened by the cost of living in South Florida. They're more concerned about their day-to-day expenses than about their needs 30 years down the road when they retire. Back in June, I had back in June I had an item on the city commission agenda to endorse in concept the proposal of a new tier in our retirement plan, and directing the administration to work with our actuarials, I never can pronounce that right, to identify options to achieve pension savings. And we never adopted the item because I think some of our colleagues at the time had concerns with it. But Commissioner Arriola, you are 100% right on that. I think I encourage you to bring the item on the agenda, and I will 100% support you on it. And I think the city attorney's office may already have an item drafted from me from June on it that they can use with your referral.
Okay, so this item, we'll hold this item until next month. We'll ask the city attorney to draft up something.
And Mr. Chair, if I may just, please, to Rob's comment that based on our city's resident population, that the area for the resident preference or the preference could be larger than just the city of Miami Beach to avoid disparate impact concerns. So we'll look at that and come back to you and work with the administration.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying. Go ahead, Commissioner.
To further a thought thread that my colleague Commissioner Fernandez had, you know, to the extent that I didn't know the workforce was 35% millennial. That's interesting. If that's the case, then a lot of those folks, you know, certainly need housing here in Miami Beach, and so maybe we should explore building housing for them. We had a proposal in November to do some office and mixed use on Lincoln Lane. Might we want to explore just making that housing, and we would give strong preference to city employees to live there, particularly millennials, so you don't have to have these, very large apartments. You can have one and two bedrooms there, and, preference given to city employees who don't even need to drive. They can just cross the street and walk to work. So it addresses the phony argument that was made that it would increase traffic, which, having local jobs, I don't know how that increases traffic. But nevertheless, we can address it by saying, look, it's going to be pure housing, mostly for City of Miami Beach employees, of which we have 2,000. Certainly 200-300 units across the street would decrease traffic.
Mr. Colleague, would you like to join forces on the pension item?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you don't have to go through that alone. But, the other thing we do with these issues is when we can't hire folks, we just contract it out at a huge expense to the city, at a huge premium. We can't hire a $300,000 engineer on our payroll, so we'll just hire a consultant to do it for us at huge costs to the city. So I would like to do everything we can to be able to get the labor we need at reasonable prices that don't unduly burden future generations of Miami Beach taxpayers.
Okay, good. I also have a referral on this agenda that will come to finance to look at the parking lot on West Avenue for parking and potential workforce housing as well. So we'll be revisiting that as well. Okay, Mr. Attorney, do you have everything you need? You're going to come back next month with a draft that we will take a look at, and we will further pursue it there. Moving on, let's call up item number 7 on the capital projects. So this is an item that I brought. I think everybody knows that I've been concerned about the allocation of the, I think it's 6 or 6.5% to all capital projects. Thank you, Rob. I appreciate your help. and on large projects, I think they get too much of an allocation to cover the cost of the department, and so I've asked the department to look at that. And so with that, Kathy, you want to tee that up?
Yes, I'll certainly do so, Commissioner. So what is currently in place for all projects, regardless of size, is a 6.5% to cover the project management costs associated with the CIP department. Based on the direction, the last time this item was brought to committee, we had the consultant go back and look at actual costs for last fiscal year, which was the first year we had where we were actually collecting timesheets on charges to capital projects. And they have reviewed that with staff and come up with a recommendation for a tiered approach in lieu of the flat 6.5%, whereby there's a larger percentage charged to the smaller projects and a smaller percentage to the larger projects, reflecting the economies of scale therein. So if you look at page 134 of your agenda, Tier 1 projects up to $1 million would be 15% of cost. Tier 2, between $1 million and $10 million would be 10% of project costs. Tier 3, between $10 million and $25 million would be 5% of project costs. And Tier 4, above $25 million would be 2% of project costs. In addition, in reviewing the charges for the last year, the consultant also made a recommendation that costs related to projects that do not yet have adopted capital budget associated with that project, right now those are charged as overhead to all existing capital projects, and therefore they use up the budget of those existing capital projects. And they recommend that in lieu of doing that, that those charges should be made to the appropriate fund while the project is in a development stage instead of charging it as overhead. So those are the two recommendations in front of you today.
Okay, good. So members, this is something that I wanted to look at, and they've spent some months, they've been collecting data for over a year, and this would be a way, instead of applying 6.5% to everything, we'd have a tiered approach. And so I would like to move this back to the commission and just bring a resolution to say, going forward with the next fiscal year, this is the way we're going to do these allocations, because I think it's more equitable. As you might remember, on the 72nd Street project, I struggled with a 6.5% being applied to an almost $85 or $90 million, which, you know, was an unreasonable allocation in my view. But we have to pay for the department. So
this is making a tier. It's not going to be uniform anymore based on the price.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
And also we'll implement it starting with the next fiscal year, and right. So we can work on it with the budget cycle this year. And so if one of you will move that, then I'll second it, and then we'll move it to the commission. And would that be in the form of a resolution, Kathy? Or?
Yes, Commissioner, it'll be a resolution reflecting that.
Okay, if you'll draft that up then and then bring bring it under my name. I guess it's under, this is my item, so just move it to the commission for the next, the March meeting, and we'll go from there.
Perfect.
Okay?
We'll do that.
So with
sure.
that,
thank
we'll,
you.
We're going to close this item out as from the committee, and we'll see it again back at the commission. Okay, great. With that, Jose, I see you're here for, let's knock out item number five. Maybe give us a quick update on the pickup lane and tell us where we're at.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Jose Gonzalez, Transportation and Mobility Director. So at last month's meeting, this body gave us the nod to move forward with the design as proposed by the city for a new pickup and drop-off lane in front of Miami Beach Senior High. At last month's meeting, we were still working with our consultant to try to define the scope and the fee for that. We've received the proposal. The design fee the estimated cost of the design fee is $160,000. We have looked in our budget and we have identified funding to be able to move forward quickly with the design. If that's the wish of this body, we would be using one of our rotational consultants for the design. As part of the design development process, the consultant will develop an opinion of probable cost for construction. The construction cost estimate that we have thus far is a planning level estimate, and it's in the realm of $600,000. But as we proceed through the design development phase, that will be refined. We anticipate the design will take about 7 months. That will include county review and approval, both county engineering as well as county school board. Miami-Dade County Public Schools would have to review and approve the design.
So you have the approximate $160,000 design fee in your budget now?
That's correct.
So I don't need to find that. Okay. And then on the construction, if it is $600,000, that's not funded yet, though, right? We would
that's
have to
correct.
Find that. And so has there been – so are we passed and is everybody in agreement with this? The school board is okay with this now?
At a concept level,
yeah.
They're committed to working with us through the design development process. I can't say
I
that they're sold.
Okay, yeah. And then have they offered any money yet or for the build?
They have not. For construction, they have not. No.
Okay. So, members, what I'd like to do is move this back to the commission. I want to move forward. This is something that we need a drop-off lane at the high school. We have the funding already, so we're not going to need to find the money. And I'd like to move that back to the commission with a resolution that we move forward with the drop-off lane and get that designed. And then I'll start calling my school board friends and the county and see if we can have a three-way partnership to split the $600,000 for the cost. Is that okay with you guys? Okay, show that done then unanimously. We'll see that back on March 27th at the commission, okay? Because I got to get that approved there. Commissioner Arriola, you have item number 9, discuss protections for tenants. Why don't we take that one?
I raised this, was it last finance meeting? I can't remember when we teed this up. Might have been land use. It's come to, I think, all of our attentions. You know, you have these situations, particularly, you know, lower income families, rental properties that, are older, sometimes not in great shape. And what happens is, an air conditioning will break, ceilings will leak, you know, just a whole host of unfortunate calamities. And a lot of these folks don't have the resources, whether they're financial, legal, or political connections, what have you, to deal with this. And a lot of these folks may not even speak English. They certainly may not know our legal system. And so they're really at the, at the mercy of the property owner and the landlord. Sometimes these landlords don't reside in Dade County. Sometimes they don't even reside in the United States. So, you know, a whole stream of events happens where it takes a very long time to rectify these situations. Meanwhile, you have families living in, you know, sometimes very unsafe conditions. So my big question for us is, you know, does the city want to devote some financial resources and some staff on a full-time basis to, be a point of, reference to help our particularly low-income families navigate financial and legal and housing matters. And it's a financial issue because to the extent that we have an appetite for that, you know, what would a budget look like? What would a position look like? What would the job description look like?
Okay. Alba, I see you're with us this morning. Let me recognize you and tell us what the city's doing now and what more we could do.
Yes, good morning. We, through our home ARP dollars, funded legal services of Greater Miami to be able to provide tenant legal services. As I mentioned in our last meeting, we have them. They have now started to be once a week in our offices to be able to provide direct care and direct services. We are actually joined today by the executive director, Monica Villegas, as well as the supervising attorney, Robert Jack, who can answer any specific questions as to the work that they've been doing or that they will be doing with our population. As of right now, we've had 13 referrals, two cases which have been closed, and three which are still open. Yesterday, coincidentally, they were in our office for the first time as their agreement just started in January. So we're very excited to be able to provide this service to the residents, and they're here in case there's any questions. We've also asked Miami-Dade County Office of Housing Advocacy, who's also on the line, Dolores Holly, in case there's any questions on what the county is also doing in regards to their tenant advocacy department.
And this new program, how are we funding that? Is that a separate line item, or we're funding that out of your department?
We're funding it through home ARP dollars, which are federal allocations.
100%?
100%, yes.
And is there a limit on, like you said, we have them one day a week. So if we need them more than one day a week, will we have the funding for that?
We hope to wrap it up to at least twice a week. But I think right now with the funding that we have, since we're just starting out, we have a quarterly update with the Finance Committee. So I think it really depends on what we see moving forward.
Okay. So one of the things I'd like, I don't know who's here that can address this, but I would like to hear what leverage do we have? So someone gets a referral, and then obviously if there's a legal issue, they're legal aid. But I'd like to know beyond that. Good morning. Just introduce yourself. You're recognized.
Good morning. I'm Monica Villegas-Patan, the executive director at Legal Services of Greater Miami, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to one do this work and invest in. Really, not only the community, but our mission. It's very aligned with what our goal for our mission is really about economic opportunity, and we think that housing stability is a critical element of that. I also want to point out we really believe in this project. We not only have the supervising attorney, we also have the attorney that's coming out to do on-site intake here, and we have our chief program officer in case there's bigger questions about grant specifics. I won't pretend to know everything about housing law. That's why we have the supervising attorney here. But I did listen to the previous meeting, so just a 20-second response to some of the concerns I heard. I heard thematically concerns about accountability and ensuring that. So just to give you a quick overview, it's two contracts together, about 220,000, just a little bit over that. We're going to be providing 120 cases of legal assistance and at least 6 outreach events, and we could always do more if there is demand for that. So making sure people know their rights. Part of any critical and successful housing case is making sure that you set it up. Those cases move fairly quickly, so we want the community to be educated about their rights and then seek the legal assistance. And then in addition to that, I hear the concern about being on site, which we are absolutely going to do. We just got confirmation that reference is checked out for the paralegal position, so we'll be staffed, which is 100% supported by this contract. So we'll have that staffing as well. But in addition to that, the office can and does refer cases to us. So if a resident comes in on a day where we're not here, we're taking that referral and contacting the resident prospective client right away. So I just wanted to address that to make sure that we are going to be responsive. And although we have a contract, if there's things that we could do to be more responsive, we're always open to doing that. Because these funds do create the ability for us to ramp up if we need to. And then the previous meeting, you had also asked if there was anything that could be done in regards to the code for more tenant protections. Due to some of our federal funding, not this funding, we are prohibited from giving that advice unless we receive a written request to do so. And at that point, if we receive that, we could provide you with what we see in other municipalities that are providing greater protections. But we would need that request in writing.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, thank you for coming in today. Yeah. I didn't know about that federal limitation, so consider this a request. We'll put it in writing. If you guys will indulge
sure.
me, just sort of help me at least understand the scope of your whole service. I'm somewhat familiar with it, but not entirely. Give me a broad overview of all the services that you provide. And then where I'm going to go with this is, to the extent that there's an appetite from my colleagues to, maybe further engage you for other things that
you're doing besides, you know, helping with, you know, housing issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, maybe we can be doing more together.
Okay, sure. So our whole mission is advancing economic opportunity and social justice. And what that translates to in our day-to-day work is, I could give you our 22 numbers because we just finished our annual report. We handled just about 4,500 cases. That's everything from providing advice to representation and even appeals. And the areas of practice run the gamut. 56% of our work was tenants advocacy last year. That's no surprise. That's county, and we actually cover Monroe County as well, so countywide. But then we also have a significant practice for denial of government benefits. So that's everything from food stamps, now known as SNAP, Social Security. We have a significant veterans project. So we have somebody who's, you have to be VA accredited. We have somebody that dedicates himself to veterans advocacy. We have a consumer unit that deals with your run-of-the-mill consumer issues, some bankruptcy, reverse mortgages, which we're seeing become a bigger problem for some of the clients that come to us at least. And I'm sure I'm forgetting something right now, but that gives you an idea in terms of what we do for individuals. And then we have a community economic development unit that represents financially eligible nonprofits and small businesses.
On the tenant advocacy side, how are what are some of your, you know, best practices, how you work? You know, how do folks know you exist? How do they know, you know, what you can do for them?
Sure. So, in terms of service delivery models, which I think is what you're referring to, clients know to come to us really, I will say when you get an eviction notice, you kind of know that you feel that you need an attorney and you seek one out. And we've been around for 56 years, so people in the community tend to know about us. But in addition to that, we're really trying to ramp up a lot of our community education efforts because things like conditions issues, which I heard referenced in the previous meeting as well, it's not as intuitive that you could seek legal assistance. And I want to be clear, because I also heard this in the previous meeting, we do not jump to litigation. We are attorneys and we can handle it and we know how to do it. But if we could resolve something with communicating with the landlord and letting them know the tenant's rights and requesting that the unit be repaired appropriately, that is, you know, obviously litigation is always... you have the possibility of that. But if it can be avoided and resolved, that's what our preference and usually the client's preference as well for obvious reasons.
That's what I think, you know, maybe, you know, we should, it's good that we're already, you know, doing something together, but I think, you know, we should more fully flesh this out to see, you know, how we can really create a model. Maybe you already have it with other cities. My vision is, you know, all of our residents here, particularly low-income residents who don't enjoy the resources other folks may have, understand things like tenants' bill of rights, that if there's something that, you know, clearly is a landlord responsibility, that they can remedy that. And what I have found is, you know, landlords will retaliate. They won't renew a lease. They'll up the rent. They do all these horrible things. And so what happens is tenants stay silent and they live in subpar apartments. And so, you know, if landlords know that the city and legal resources will be brought to bear if they don't do the right thing, you know, maybe we can get them to be more responsive. And so, you know, I'd love to explore having, you know, an operating model that's quick to address real issues. I'm not one to, you know, want to litigate or turn your office or our city into, you know, a plaintiff's bar where people go seek, you know, constant monetary damage. This is just about making sure that properties are constantly upkept and that, you know, low-income people and people here whose, you know, immigration status, you know, may be in question and therefore, you know, have additional fears, know that, you know, they can have the safety and dignity of living in an apartment or housing unit that is safe and that meets all codes and that they don't have to fear retaliation, that their concerns are quickly addressed. So yeah, I'd like to put together a model for us to have as a city.
So what, who do you need a letter from? The city manager just asking for this or?
Commissioner would be fine, yeah.
Okay, so
I'll send you one.
Commissioner Ariola will send you a letter, right? And so then, Commissioner, it's your item. I would like to keep it open here because I'd like all of you to come back. Well, when we get the results from the letter, we'll have something else to talk about. But then also, in 3 or 4 months, it would be great to get an update on how many cases you've heard and a resolution. How are you doing outreach? How are we letting our residents? How are we letting our residents know that this service is available?
So when initially we got the home ARP funds that Commissioner Fernandez sponsored, the item to be able to look at legal services and what they were doing, we worked with communications as well as legal services to get the word out there to our community residents. And we're also working on a PSA.
Okay, great. Perfect. All right, so Commissioner Arreola is going to send you a letter. You're going to get us something back. We'll keep this in.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to send the letter. We've worked with legal services in the past on all of in the last year, whether it was Commissioner Fernandez's rent increase ordinance that protected tenants, or Commissioner Richardson, your recent ordinance for unsafe structures and reimbursing all of the expenses that for tenants that are displaced. We've conferred with legal services for both of those items, and they've given us very helpful feedback. Okay. And we're very grateful that they're here, since our office does not represent the general public as much as we'd like to. It's just we serve in a different role. But to the extent that we could collaborate with your folks, you know, we're happy to do that.
So why don't you coordinate with Commissioner Arreola's office, and one of you or both of you send a letter out. Let's get that. And then this is February. Maybe we'll have a response by April. So we'll hold this open and come back in April with an update, and then maybe you, at the same time, you can just tell us how it's going with the number of cases and that sort of thing. So with that, I want to close this out.
Question of Alba, with respect to your outreach and stuff, community workshops, obviously, you know, Spanish, Creole, you know, all the different languages, might you think about, places where, lower income folks for whom these services will be the most useful, things like mass transit, so bus stops, trolleys, advertising there so that they understand, hey, look, you can look up on this website, you can call this number. We have a community workshop every, couple of months, so you can come and attend, so that, they can quickly, arm themselves with the information they need when things come up.
Absolutely.
Okay. We all know what we're doing on this one. Okay. We're going to close that today, but we will keep it open and bring it back in April. Let's call item number 8. This is yours, Vice Chair Fernandez, on establishing universal rental application fee processing program. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on the issue of housing and helping tenants, one of the things that is most difficult for tenants is when they're applying for housing, just the cost to apply for housing or to be considered for housing. On average, an application fee can run between $40 to $135 per renter, and that's just an application fee. And according to our staff, filling out these fees could cost a renter over $500 when they're looking for new housing. And this really affects those who are on the tightest income streams that are capped in their income. And so I would like our city to find a way for qualifying individuals to help subsidize the cost of these applications, because there's nothing worse than if there is housing that they can afford in Miami Beach, that they may not be able to then actually afford the cost of applying for it. And I want to recognize Alba so that she could present the recommendation that they brought forward.
Go ahead, you're recognized.
Thank you. We explored different options with our city attorney's office that would limit, obviously, the city's any liability or potential exposure with a universal rental assistance process. And the administration, we support the exploration of a pilot program to reimburse tenants once they do these applications, to be able to reimburse them. And we can either explore this through the fiscal year 24 process or potentially the home ARP dollars. Since we will be going out to RFP, we could potentially amend the action plan and explore that a little bit further if we wanted to.
Okay. And Commissioner, you mentioned $500. That's because people are doing two or three or four applications.
Right. Sometimes if you don't have good credit, and which is oftentimes the issue when you're in limited income situations, they may have to apply one, two, three places before a landlord accepts them for their property. So it could cost them in the process of finding a home over $500. On average, this is what our staff estimates. And so if we could create some sort of grant program for low-income tenants where perhaps the city could reimburse those costs, I think it could be something good to pilot. And it'll be interesting to see how that would help those in our community that we're trying to keep our community affordable for them.
Alba, do we have federal dollars now that we could use for this program?
We do have $277,000 in home ARPA dollars that have not been allocated. We could potentially explore it. I will just say that with home ARPA funds, obviously the caveat of 80% AMI is a very strict rule.
Yeah. So one of the things that I like this, the idea of this program, but I'm just curious, Commissioner Fernandez, I'd like people... I'd like everybody to still have a little bit of skin in the game.
Yeah.
So, because if you don't have any skin in the game, they could do 10 applications, right? So I'd like there to be like an 80% reimbursement so they have 20% skin in the game and also have it limited to, say, $500 per person so that, you know, we're not getting too much. And I would be in favor of having... a pilot program up to $50,000, which is really that would be what potentially 100 people. So that's I don't know that we would even need that much this fiscal year. But if you have the funds, what would we need to do? Move this back to the commission with that recommendation?
We would need to first amend the action plan to include this. We would obviously want to work out what the particulars would be for whether what type of reimbursement we would want to do, whether it be for a certain specific amount or for after a person has spent a certain amount of dollars, that we would then reimburse them a portion potentially. So we could explore different options of reimbursement. And
so do we want to have them work on that and bring it back next month with a plan?
Yeah, I like that suggestion. I like your suggestion of the 80% reimbursement. The one thing that I would like for us to keep in mind, certainly we have a big population of low-income tenants. If somehow we could look and see how we can go a little bit beyond low-income tenants, because I think in our... in our expensive community, it is very expensive to live in Miami Beach. It's not just low income. We may have individuals who are not low income, but for whom it may be expensive. When we put it in the perspective of Miami Beach, and so perhaps if we can find the way, I know we can't do it with the funds you're speaking of, but see if there's any other funding source, any grants available that would allow us to go a little bit beyond that low income. Status.
Because I think you just said, what is the, with the federal dollars, it's 80%?
80% AMI, yes.
Okay. So one of the things we could do is, why don't you work on it, bring it back next month with that, and then let's take the second piece of that, that people who would not qualify where we can't use the federal, and let's, why don't you come back with a recommendation on how, what we could do, and we will then work on that for the next budget cycle, and we'll expand in that and put another pot of money, whether it's another $50,000 or whatever. I don't know how much we're going to need, but let's do it in two steps.
I like that. That's a great suggestion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so let's do that. Let's go ahead and we'll bring this back next month with an action plan on how we're going to do the federal, and then if you don't have time to work on the other piece, we'll give you another month to do that.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We appreciate your help. Commissioner Fernandez, let's talk about iguanas. Oh, go ahead. All right, perfect. Let's see. Let's just take a five-minute break. We're 5 minutes away from our time certain, and I don't want to open up something else, so everybody have a stretch break, and we'll be back in 5 minutes.
Get a cup of coffee. Thank you.
Get a coffee. We are reconvening the finance meeting, and we have a 10:30. We have a time certain for item two and item three on the waste hauler items. These items, item two and item three. Item three is really related to the fact that our contract for commercial has expired, and we're on a month-to-month, and so we've been talking for the last several months about how we want to proceed as a city. I think the one decision that has been made is that we've made a decision to have multiple franchise opportunities as opposed to a single hauler. And just for the record, the residential contract is still in place and has not expired. So what we're doing is talking about the commercial, which is applicable to commercial businesses and condominiums, I believe. So with that, Mr. Gomez, you're recognized, and tell us where we're at. We're also at the same time going to be talking, we'll talk about number three first, and then we'll move to number two as well and incorporate this conversation as well. So go ahead, Mr. Gomez, you're recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Joe Gomez, Public Works Director, committee members. I have a brief presentation, and I know you like brevity, Mr. Chair, so it's 11 slides, but I promise I'll go through them quickly, and it'll cover both items, both the 9 to 24, and as well as the franchise fees. So, PJ, next.
PJ, please. Do you have the slide deck? You can, there it is. Okay, go ahead.
No, that's not it.
No.
It's embedded in item number three, PJ. Presentation is.
PJ, I don't know if you, it's page 13 of 213 on the in the printed copy. I don't know if you can bring that up.
Yes, just give me 1 second. I'm loading the Novus right now, sure. So go ahead and download.
Take
that.
Your time.
1 second.
I don't know if is Amy in Chambers as well. If not, if she's listening to this, she can come to Chambers because I'm going to want her to talk about what we're doing with the sustainability. So if someone on staff could text her, I don't know if she's listening to this or she's, I don't see her here.
And I did communicate with environment and sustainability this morning, and I do have some information regarding that as well.
Okay, great.
So I can address it.
Perfect. There it is.
All right.
Thank
Excellent.
You, PJ.
Thank you, PJ. Next, please. So two specific things that you asked us to address, Mr. Chair. Obviously, looking at the multifamily residences, the issue of raising the cap from the current 8, which is part of the residential, up to 8 multifamily units, considered part of the residential, to potentially increasing it to less than 25, and also to talk about the franchise fees and how those were developed. Next, please. So one of the questions you had, Mr. Chair, was the issue of how that number, that magical number 8, came up. And based on all the research we've done, that was really an administrative decision that was done years ago, making that threshold the 8 multifamily units or less is part of the residential. That's essentially the research that we've been able to discern. What you also asked us to meet with Commissioner Fernandez to discuss the issue of the 8 to 25. Commissioner Fernandez and I spoke this morning and provided him some additional information. And then do a comparison what other municipalities are doing in terms of the franchise fees. Next, please. So just very quickly, under the current existing agreements, we have 2 non-exclusive franchises. Those are the commercial. The franchises were select based on qualifications, not price, and that's part of the City Code Section 990-229, which defines that. And then franchises are afforded the opportunity to set prices based on their with their customers, based on the competitive market, and with no regulatory control by the city. Condos, apartment buildings, and multifamily units, 8 units or less, are considered single family and are covered under the exclusive, current exclusive single family contract. And then 9 units or more, of course, are part of the commercial. Next, please. So, based on our research, based on discussions with our procurement office and also in consultation with the city attorney's office, there's two options that to take. If we want to raise the cap, the current cap of 8 to 24, so that would be 9 to 24, there are two options. We could either, A, number one, issue a separate RFP to cover the 9 to 24. It would have to be an exclusive because it's got to be based on price. So it would be a request for proposals rather than a request for qualifications. And those, then the prices would be negotiated during the time with the successful bidder or bidders. Then the second option would be to do a bid waiver on the current existing residential contract that we have right now that expires. It's the first five-year term expires at the end of this calendar year, December the 31st of 2023. Then we have 3 one-year options that we can exercise. The second option would be to do a bid waiver under the current contract to negotiate those prices for the 9 to 24 threshold under that current contract. That would be require a bid waiver, which would require a 5/7 vote of the commission. We feel that this would be a good option because it would provide some price stability on a contract that's already in place so we can negotiate with the current holder of that contract. Next, please. The next two slides, I'll go through them very quickly, and Rafael Paz was kind enough to provide us an in-depth analysis of this. But essentially, under the current code 90-97, it defines single-family waste contractors, and it's based on established fixed pricing. So 97 it defines that. And then commercial, for the commercial haulers, that's defined under 90-229, and that basically is we award franchises. Those franchises are agreements to let the haulers, and our current under our current code, we can select up to five. Up to five. We have right now two, but we can select up to five, and allows us to select those, and then they would set pricing based on market conditions. Next, please. Under either scenario, under option one or option two, if we were going to extract the 9 to 24 out of the current multifamily commercial non-exclusive contracts, it would require amendments to the city code. That would be an amendment to section 90-97 because that specifically defines that residential is up to the multifamily up to 8 units. So if we're going to move that threshold to 24, it would require an amendment to the code. Also, if we were to go with option two and extend the term of that contract for whatever reasons, we would have to then, at that point, also amend section 90-230, which sets the term limits of the contract, which is 5 years plus 3 one-year extensions. So at this point, Mr. Chair, I'll pause in case any of the committee members have any questions, then I'll move on to the issue of the franchise fees.
Let's go ahead and go through the franchise fees. Okay. Yeah, and then we'll do questions
after that. Very good. Okay. So next, please. Okay. Thank you, PJ. So essentially right now our franchise fees for the commercial are 22%. It's 20% plus 2% for working within the city's right-of-way. That number represents 24% of sanitation's operational expenditures. In fiscal year 2022, as an example.
Say that again, because I want everybody to hear that.
Yes.
Say that again, slowly.
I'll say it slowly.
Yeah.
So our franchise fees are 22%. That's what we collect from our commercial franchise haulers,
22%. It's 22 plus an additional 2%.
No, it's 20 plus 2%, sir, 22%.
Okay. Okay, I'm being told it's 22 plus 2, so let's figure out. What is it? Is it 20 plus 2 is 22, or is it 22 plus 2 is 24?
It's
okay. We'll get to the number then. Okay. It's either 22 or 24, all inclusive.
The 22% though, represents 24% of our operational expenses in our sanitation
budget. So 24% of the entire sanitation budget is derived from this, the franchise fees collected from the waste haulers, which really comes from the citizens. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. And that, if you see the numbers up on the presentation, that essentially is about $5.5 million. And then the city for the residential charges a service fee on the base fee that we charge for sanitation. And that's that service fee is $16.44 for single family and $12.01 for multifamily up to eight. Remember, again, zero to eight multifamily, that's part of the residential.
Okay, let me, so, I'm going to pause you there because I want everybody here to understand exactly what's going on because it can be a little complicated. So I originally started asking questions about the franchise fee or tax, as I call it, and because I was wondering why the commercial has this but not the homeowners. But what I've learned and what Mr. Gomez is explaining is that with respect to the residential, the waste hauler, and there's this one single one, sends a master bill to the city. The city then sends out invoices to all of the homeowners. And when they do that, there's an additional fee, a markup, that is actually greater than the 22% or 24%, whatever the number is, than the commercial. So there is a markup on the residential as well. With and, that, go ahead, sir.
And for context, that service charge for the residential and the multifamily residential represents another $1.2 million for or 5% of the operational expenses of sanitation. So combined between the two, that's about 30% of the operational expenses of sanitation.
Okay.
Next, please. So then you asked us to look at other, to compare other franchise fees in relation to the city of Miami Beaches. So we looked at a total of 32 municipalities that were queried. Five were removed from the analysis because the franchise fee was embedded into their rate, so it was very difficult to extract. So out of the 27 municipalities, both exclusive and non-exclusive, 12 of the 27 we looked at because they were within the range of what the city charges. We were charging 22%, so we wanted to get a comparison of peaches to peaches in terms of looking at them. So out of the 12 of these, out of the 27 were within that range, and if you take the aggregate average of those franchise fees, it's 24.6%, so it's higher than the city of Miami Beaches. And the city of Weston, for example, has the highest that we were able to discern at 35%. And then if you take out, just looking at non-exclusive, there were only four, and those non-exclusives averaged 26%. So again, we're below that threshold. So again, the important thing is that to recognize that these fees are critically important our ability to be able to operate our sanitation department. Next. That's just a spreadsheet of the numbers that I went through that I just provided for backup. Next, please. So this is a breakdown, Mr. Chair, that you had asked in terms of all the different parts, how we use the franchise fees for, and this list, and I'm not going to go, you have it there, but specifically the one I wanted to highlight was the, and I know you had questions about it when we met, the 2% monthly gross receipts for sustainable programs that are overseen by the Environmental and Sustainability Program. And I can tell you that from the information that I got, for example, for the fiscal year 23 budget, $498,000 are set aside. That includes dune enhancement, North Beach Compost Hub. It also funds positions within the Environmental and Sustainability Department. And certain awards that are given, philanthropic awards that are promoted to promote and support environmental and sustainability programs within the city.
Okay, so with that, about the 2%, and eventually I'm going to, because I keep hearing 22 and 24 is the total. We'll get to that. But, Amy, you get your department is funded with the 2%, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's about a half million a year.
Yes, Commissioner, $498,000 in the fiscal year.
We'll round it up to half a million.
Okay.
What do you do with that money?
Sure. So it funds about 2.5 positions within the department. It also funds $195,000 for dune enhancement and restoration, our Northeast Compost Hub at $55,000, Malloy Channel no-wake water zone markers, sustainability campaigns such as Plastic-Free MB, and then $25,000 in grant awards to philanthropic organizations such as, you know, cleanup organizations for beaches. And that's about it.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
And so to legal, you know, I started looking at, like, asking questions about the franchise fee, and all these municipalities are doing it, so, and I ask about state law, and so I guess what I hope what we do is consistent with state law. Can you confirm that, right?
It is, Mr. Chair, and to your comment before that you consider it a tax, it's not a tax. We have the exclusive right to own and operate our waste collection utility, and what you're doing when you're awarding the franchise is you're giving up the right to operate it yourself, and so the fee is the consideration for awarding the franchise. So it's not a tax, and it's, you know, the courts throughout the country have consistently held that it's not a tax and upheld franchise fees on that basis.
No,
the amount is up to you to consider.
And I totally understand. As I'm peeling the onion back, about 25% of our sanitation budget is paid for by this. If we did not fund it through the franchise, we would have to increase our millage rate, actually. So that's when I say it's really a tax, because in my view, as a resident, I'm paying, rather than paying for it in my property taxes, I'm paying for it in my fee, and I'm not disputing that it's legal. I totally understand that it's completely legal. So with that, I want to open up and do some public comment, and we're going to keep that brief, but I think some of the so basically where we are now is one decision has been made, and that is that on this contract, there's been a recommendation that we have multiple franchise opportunities. Beyond that, we're going to need to make some decisions whether or not we move this back to the commission today or we keep it here if there's more work to be done. But we're going to have to decide on the question of whether or not we want to expand from 8 to 24. We're going to have to decide how many waste haulers we want to recommend to send back to the commission and the format of that contract. So with that, if there are any waste haulers or interested parties in the audience that would like to speak, I will recognize you one by one by one. If you have any comments or recommendations to the committee on how we might structure a contract going forward, this is your opportunity to speak. Anyone who wants to speak, anyone. Okay, come on up, Mohammed. And Mitch will take you next. And if there's anyone online?
There is.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Islam. You're recognized for 2 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and commissioners and others. This is Mohammed Islam. I'd like to say about something about the hauler prices. Because we are residents, I see a lot of they charge in different way. I don't know, but there should be a regulatory regulated by the city, because I see in one of my property, I'm paying one of the hauler company 4-unit building, which is have the categorized. I already sent a proposal to Mr. Bedford Kane, sanitation director, to review these things, and this has to be categorized like a single unit, 4-unit, until 8-unit, which is a residential unit. And after that, it should be commercial unit. This is already, I saw in the day already. So we need to be a control. We need to be control. We need to be get a fixed price for every hauler should be same price, now as per categorized. So my concern is one hauler, 2-unit building, they charge $150. And next, other one, charge $120. So there is a difference. Recently, I have a bad example. I have a property. I used to pay $167. They're jumping to $207. That is, I calculated, it is 25% increase. They say we have a franchise fee with this. As a residence, all are our interest. We have to cap this. They cannot jumping like this. At maximum, raise like 5%. This is a very vital point. We have to be, we cannot increase like this. And has to be all hauler company has to be same rate, and who has to be cities has to be regulate these things. And this is my point. And other things, we have to categorize which is residential, which is commercial. Until 8 units is commercial, because there's a by how many people occupied in 2-unit building, 4-unit building, 8-unit building, but has to be by categorized, and as per categorized, we can have to be a charge. And that charge has to be, whatever it is, if you see the details of the bills, there is a franchise fee, other fee, all the fee should be the same as per categorized property. So my concern has to be cap on, they say there is a maximum and should be valid reason. Like a fuel charge is very high. But nowadays, is fuel is normal, regular prices. And they're jumping the price 25%. It is a very tough situation. How residents are paying this? Residents has to be have some valid reason that we can have to afford to. So as a residents, as a my beach, paying the bills, so we need to be control this. So it has to be city must be control this by regulating. Okay.
Thank
so
you very
this
much.
This is my concern.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Bierman. You're next. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mitch Bierman from Weiss Serota Helfman Colin Bierman. We represent Waste Connections. As you know, Waste Connections is the contract residential hauler, as well as one of the two franchisees that hold current franchises. We've worked closely with your staff and would like to offer to continue to do so to help you find the best solutions to the issues that you identified today. As your staff pointed out, and I think it's very important, the cost basis for what we do, and it seems like a very simple matter, bringing a truck to a property, loading the waste into the truck, taking it away, and disposing it. But as much as prices, consumer prices have increased for everything from eggs to entertainment, the costs of the essential elements of waste disposal and hauling have increased exponentially. And so some of what you're hearing from your residents is the same frustration that the industry faces, which is that it can't continue to keep the same prices if its costs keep escalating. And fuel, labor, and the cost of these vehicles are three areas that far exceed the already outrageously high CPI. And I think it's just an important thing to keep in mind. Meanwhile, we do everything we can to work with your city to keep prices within a manageable place. And we will, if what you ultimately decide is to merge the 9 to 25 unit buildings into the residential, obviously we can accommodate that. There are a lot of logistic issues involved in that, but we'll find a way to do it. And if you decide to do something different, we'll be here to try to help manage that as well.
And just to be clear, your client has both the residential contract now, which is a single source, and you're also one of the two franchise, right?
That's correct.
Exactly. Let me ask you this question, because under this contract, we could, as Mr. Gomez says, we could have up to five franchise, and we're going to get a recommendation from staff on that going forward. But at one time, there were three, and then we're down to two. What could we do? Because if we have three or four and then we lose again and get back to two, what can we do to ensure that if we get a recommendation that the number's three or four, whatever the number's going to be, that we maintain that? And I'll get advice from our legal staff as well. But
yeah, it can be tricky. And my, because in the past, the reason that you've had fewer franchisees than you started with is because of consolidation in the industry, and it's very difficult to really predict how that's going to go, or you know what ultimately happens. Companies that are smaller companies are often interested in being sold because obviously the owners tend to do well on those sales. It's hard to really fix that problem, but
then it reduces competition.
And it potentially reduces competition, yeah. Although when you have two, you have competition, and the competition is fierce. What I would say is that we are very happy with the competitive atmosphere in terms of having at least two. I don't believe Waste Management, certainly not Waste Connections, were too enthusiastic about the prior suggestion, which you said has been rejected, to go with a single franchise hauler. We're more comfortable with having competition than we are with a sole source on that. Whether you have three or four, I'm not sure ultimately how you keep three or four unless you just add, if you have three and then you add another one if one is consolidated. You can always do that. You're free to do that. You can just have an RFP for a third permit if you get down to two. That's one of the things that you could do. But we are hopeful that as this moves forward, that we have another opportunity to continue to serve the city of Miami Beach.
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else want to be heard? Yes, sir, you're recognized. Just go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, who you represent, and you have 2 minutes.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Luciano Isla. I'm an attorney at law. I represent offices at 6625 Miami Lakes Drive East, Suite 424. I'm also a resident of the Carriage Club North Condominium in Miami Beach. That's my homestead, Suite 1418. May I approach, Mr. Chairman, the dais?
You can give those to the attorney.
Sure.
Just hand those to the attorney, and he will distribute those to us. Go ahead. You're recognized.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I've handed out Section 90-229 of the city. It is a current code of the city, and it provides the city with the authority to grant up to 5 solid waste franchises, commercial franchises, in the city. And it also provides a system whereby, as the director has recommended, through an RFQ process, these companies can qualify and submit their qualifications to the city. The manager will review it with the director, and ultimately the city council will make a decision as to which, if any, up to 5. So the opportunity, let's work first on the opportunity to let it out without going by the numbers that are in your statute, open it up, and let the companies bring their RFQs. Let the commission decide, and the staff and the city manager make their recommendations to the full commission, and then go from there. I represent the Florida Waste Haulers and Recyclers Coalition. We are in favor of free and open competition. Only 2 companies working in Miami Beach is, in effect, a monopoly of 2. And monopolies are not in the best interest of the city or the small property owners of the small buildings. So the more that we have competition, 5 is a number that are allowed by your statute. Let's compete. Let's put our qualifications out. Let's put our prices out and let the commission decide how do we do it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for your time. Come on up. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. You get 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. You guys have seen me before. I'm Tabitha Pennington. I'm a resident. I work with a property management company, and I also manage construction projects. I'm also somewhat of an expert in this type of field because I'm actually an environmental geologist with a lean toward GIS and political science. So public administration was part of it. I worked for a city in the waste side before I resigned to come to Miami Beach. This has not been working. And since the last time I saw you guys, the whole situation has actually escalated. I have Northwest is one of the brokers that we work with that gets us really good prices. One of my associations does 12 units. Their price was just raised by the hauler after it ended from $327 a month to $700. They did not give an explanation. They are not working with anyone. They're not budging. So I know you want to open it up to have competition, but there really isn't any because all of the brokers are making a nosedive to Waste Connections because Waste Management went out the roof, and they are also getting rid of the trucks that can handle the toters, which are the bins, the plastic bins. A lot of your properties do not have the space to put a dumpster, so that automatically removes anyone that's not willing to deal with those bins. On the other side, when you are dealing with the condominium association, they are commercial. They have the option to go residential if they're 8 or under, but because of the way the rules work, they have to have an individual bin for each unit because each unit is a single-family home. And each one of those people has to come out to move those bins to the corner in order to receive residential service. There is no way the city is going to grant permits to have a pile of recycling and garbage bins out at a building so that they can try to get on residential service. So you should consider this while you're discussing because the prices have gone out the roof.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Anyone else? Go ahead. Tell us who you are and you're recognized for 2 minutes.
Hi, good morning. My name is Jason Neal. I'm with Waste Management, Inc. of Florida. We are one of the commercial franchisees. And I agree partially with some of the other speakers in that we are open to more competition in Miami Beach. There are currently 2 commercial franchisees. There have been as many as 5. Over time, they get acquired. Most recently was SWS a couple of years ago. Prior to that, it was Choice, it was General, it was Davis, it was A1, AmeriCarding. It's just you go on and on. The smaller companies tend to get acquired. Chair, to your question, you know, how do you prevent that? I don't know that you can. I don't know if the city is legally entitled to prevent a sale of that license or not. That's more of a legal issue. But as Mr. Bierman said, you can certainly bring in more franchisees should that happen. I do want to point out a couple things. First of all, on pricing, yes, the prices have gone up significantly. Materials have gone up. Fuel has gone up. We use CNG in our trucks. It's really gone through the roof. Those trucks cost more, but they're also more environmentally friendly. That's what we choose to use. When we raise our prices to our customers, we have certain things that we're allowed to raise for. Fuel, disposal fees, and CPI are typically the things that are automatically included in our agreement. If we need to raise or choose to raise for other purposes, customers are free to cancel. They don't even have to negotiate. They're free to cancel if they have a better offer. So we're not opposed to that. I do want to point out differences between the 2 contracts we're talking about. Your single-family homes are all generic. They all get twice-a-week garbage. They all get recycling, but not through the franchisee. That's through the county, and they all get bulk. These 9 to 24s, they typically have dumpsters. They could go twice a week. They could go 3 times, 4 times, 5, or more. Recycling is provided by the franchisee, unlike your single-family. Some of them are long rollouts. Some of them you just approach. They're all over the board. And so those are priced not by the unit. They're priced by the service need. So there is a fundamental difference between those two. I'm of the opinion that if the city wants those to be carved out, it should not be through a bid waiver. There's no mechanism for determining a fair price. It should be through an RFP. I actually think the best option is to let the market do its work, and when you bring in more franchisees, keep them where they're at.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Go ahead, sir. You're recognized. Tell us who you are and who you represent, and you've got 2 minutes.
Thank you very much. My name is Willie Hernandez. I represent Great Waste and Recycling. We are a local Dade County privately owned company providing services right here in Miami Beach to our children of our schools for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And we're paying full franchise fees to the city at this time. However, we want to keep in mind that our hopes, our hopes and aspirations for this perfect time for the city to allow for competition to come in, just as we did when we did the schools for the kids, for our students here in Miami Beach, Miami Beach High, the elementary schools. We were able to bring an invaluable service to the city during COVID, where we were providing these services and we are paying in full all the franchise fees. So we support the city creating more of a competitive environment instead of an oligopoly. That's the bottom line, is that there's been a comfortable situation. We're here. We want to work with you. We're part of the community, and we support our children, and we hope you do too.
So just so that I'm clear, you have the contract through the school board to do the waste hauling from the public schools?
Yes, Honorable Chair. We are the contractor for all the Miami-Dade County public schools, and we were awarded the BTR under the auspices to service the schools and pay the franchise fees. So we are Great Waste and Recycling, has a BTR, and pays the free franchise fees and full franchise fees to the city. We will always continue to do that. This one thing, by bringing in competition and opening up the market to bringing aggressive companies like ours, is that it's going to create competition, and at the same time, you will still collect 100% of all your fees.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Anyone else want to be heard on this? Online, we've got...
You have one caller, Mitch Novak. Go ahead, Mitch.
Mr. Novak, go ahead. You're recognized for 2 minutes.
Hi, good morning. Mitch Novak here. I would agree that franchise fees are a tax, which ultimately impact housing affordability. Years ago, going back over two decades, we had up to 8 haulers we could choose from, and I agree that the smaller haulers always get swallowed up by either of the two that are in place. Right now, they do have a monopoly. We need to change that. We need at least 4 or 5 haulers to choose from, where the residents and small business owners would ultimately benefit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch. Is Dave Dobler on? Because he wanted to talk a little bit about the sustainability issues as it relates to the contract.
He is not, sir.
Okay.
He is now. He is now.
Can we bring him in?
Sure, Dave. Go ahead.
Dave, go ahead. I know you had some initiatives, sustainability related issues that you wanted the committee to consider moving forward. So. Go ahead, I recognize you, and I know you might need a couple of more minutes so we'll give you Dara's time too. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Dave Dobler, Miami Beach resident at 800 West Avenue. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person, but I haven't cleared yet from COVID. I'd like to thank Commissioner Richardson for giving me a few minutes today to share 9 requirements that I hope that you will direct staff to include in the waste hauler agreements and negotiations to improve street cleanliness and improve recycling rates. These are some basic things that I believe our waste hauler partners would be happy to comply with. Is my slide deck available?
Yes, they just put it up there, Dave.
Thank you so much. I can see it perfectly. All right, so next slide, please. So we'll have to build this out a little bit here. The waste hierarchy is a universal strategy for how we deal with waste, with the least preferred method of disposal at the bottom of the pyramid, which is basically putting it in the ground in a landfill where it's going to sit for centuries. If you can build that out, please, the slide. Excellent. So that's what landfills look like, and we're just burying stuff because there really is no away when we throw things away. Higher up in that is waste to energy incineration, which is better because we are able to get rid of the waste and create energy from it. If you could build that slide out, please. And this is the Covanta plant in Doral. However, unfortunately, last week, the plant went up in flames. So if you can build out the slide, there you go.
Hey, Dave, let's do this, because I want to help you move along. Let's get to the nine things you want the committee to consider, and let's go through those so you don't get cut off, okay? Thanks.
Great, okay. So we have two challenges. One is our streets are dirty, basically, from waste bins, and the second is that recycling throughout Miami Beach has very high contamination rates. 30 to 40% of the material in recycling bins is unwanted material. It's because people don't understand what can be recycled, and people can't tell what bin to put their material in. All of the bins are identical. I'd like to play a quick little game with everybody here.
Dave, you're my friend. I want you to get to the nine things because you're going to get cut off, okay?
Great. Okay. If we can just click through, and as this is built out, you will see that you can't tell which bin is which.
Yep.
So, all right, so here we go. So there are nine items. One is that the bins all need to have unified color and large standardized messaging. You can't tell which is recycling, which is landfill, and so people just throw everything in everywhere. There are some standardized labels, and the City of Miami Beach Communications and Sustainability Team can work on that. Two is require annual educational materials, preferably electronic, from the waste hauler to condo buildings to be sent to residents, HOAs, and businesses to educate people on proper recycling. Three is audit. The waste hauler should be auditing their customers' recycling bins to reduce contamination. They're starting to use in-truck cameras that can do all this automatically. The four is the waste hauler should submit quarterly reports of their waste hauler contamination rates so that CMB staff can go through and figure out how we can improve recycling and decrease contamination. Next slide, please. Five is that the waste, and these are items to improve cleanliness and service levels. Over the years, we have had really dirty, leaky trucks from some of the vendors, and that just drips smelly, gross stuff on our streets and makes our streets dirty. So this can be done through, this is just basically because some of the vendors were not maintaining their traps properly. Number six is that make sure that the collection staff actually picks up litter that falls out. There are a number of, Dave,
let me take it from here. So put the slide back up. It's number seven. Penalties, liquidated damages. Number eight, waste hauler trucks should run on cleaner, low-carbon fuels. And number nine, include space for innovative. Okay, so those are nine things you want us to consider. And sorry to cut you off, but I just want to keep everybody on an equal playing field. Thank you so much, Dave. We'll be back in touch with you to discuss these items. So let's turn. Is there anyone else that wants to speak? This is your opportunity. Going once, going twice, gone. City Manager Hudak, we'd love to hear from you.
I would just like to take a minute to talk and to sort of frame this appropriately, because I think there's a lot of talk about different waste streams, and it's getting a little bit convoluted, so I'd like to sort of bring it back to the issue at hand. There are multiple things that we're talking about here. We're talking about commercial waste collection, we're talking about residential, and now we're talking about recycling as well, all of which have, you know, a very complex myriad of flows and waste hauling options and expensive solutions that this community has experienced for many, many years. The fire at the waste-to-energy plant is really going to complicate the scenario in the future, and the county is going to have significant challenges in terms of how waste flows. And I have to say that I have to commend the Miami-Dade Solid Waste Department for seamlessly collecting 350,000 residences on Monday after the fire and the continuation of the fire. We collect from residential about 6,000 residential. Our commercial accounts are significantly different. But I think it's very important to understand that today we're talking about commercial. We have a residential existing contract that has options to renew, so we're really not talking about the residential contract at all today. The recycling contract, which we use the county's contract, is going to get more expensive because recycling throughout this entire country is contaminated. There's no market in China, And the reality is that recycling contamination is a very real issue throughout the entire country. And there is a tremendous amount of things that we can continue to do in terms of education. But that is a reality of the recycling contract. And we will, this city will see an increase in recycling cost as the entire country is currently experiencing. And by the way, this city, unlike the county, actually subsidizes the cost of collecting recycling, and we incorporate that into our budget, and that is something that is also funded directly by our budget. It is not something that our residents pay for, the actual cost of recycling. But again, that's a conversation for another day, but a very important cost factor to keep in mind as we're talking about the implications of a franchise fee and the collection of a franchise fee. So my biggest concern, you know, and what I really want to put on the record is whatever the committee decides in terms of the framework of the RFP, we've made a professional recommendation to you, and obviously we're here to modify that in whatever way our policymakers want us to. We need to be competitive. We need to make sure that we are continuing to collect the revenue that is necessary to provide the level of service that our residents have grown accustomed to, both our commercial residents as well as our residential residents. And we need to make sure that what we do, that we stay focused on commercial today, and that the issues and the implications of the costs, because they're all intertwined, we can continue to discuss in committee. But we're on a month-to-month, and we really need to make a decision, and we need to move one way or the other.
Just so you're clear, Madam Manager, I'm not in favor of eliminating the franchise fee. My questions originated because I was curious why one group of residents were paying it and another group seemingly did not. But what I've learned is that everybody's paying some sort of fee. It's just been structured in a different way. Yes. So I'm comfortable with that. I also recognize and have been told that the way we're doing it is consistent with state law. And again, I'm comfortable with that. So I'm not looking to put a $10 million hole in your budget or mine as the finance chair. So
I know that you are not. But I was concerned, and I thought this was a really good opportunity to impress upon everyone that in addition to what you've discovered, we also subsidize recycling.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of things we need to decide. I don't know that we're ready to move this right now out of committee. We might need one more month, but I think we need to have a discussion about the number nine through 24. I have some serious concerns about expanding that. I heard something for the first time today. I don't know, with the 8-unit buildings, are they required to have 8 different individual bins, or are they able just to collect trash? Who can address that? I don't know if that's a Waste Connections question, or that's something that was new I had not heard before. So, hi, tell us who you are.
Good morning. My name is Grant Smith. I represent Waste Connections. Perfect. And the answer to your question is yes. The 2 to 8s, of which there are, I believe, 200 of them maybe. Statistics somewhere in here, but sure. There's 200 of them, I think. And they comprise about 1,300 units. That's the universe of them. So there's, you know, let's say there's 10 twos and 40 fours and, you know, things like that. And yes, they get service much like the single-family residences do. So your single-family residence has the option of putting out bags, or you can go to Home Depot or Lowe's or someplace and buy a garbage pail and put those out, or put them in the backyard and our folks will go get them through the backdoor service. But for the 2s to 8s, it is operated the exact same way. My understanding is that I had this conversation with our on-the-ground supervisor 2 days ago, and my understanding is that of those 2 to 8s that we service, there's only one of them that has a dumpster.
Okay. Well, that certainly would create an issue if we want to expand it, because then we're dealing with 24 different bins at a building. So I'm not in favor of expanding. I don't know how the 8 got included to begin with, but if you follow the line of the argument that too many trucks are going down the street, it just is a coincidence that Waste Connections has both the residential and the commercial. But if you want to think about the fact that that those could be two different vendors. Let's say that we had three or four and the residential was a different, then we've really got five different trucks going down the street. So for that reason, I'm not in certainly would like to hear, you know, from you, Commissioner, because you brought it in, you as well. But I don't know how the eight got included. I would not have been supportive of that, especially now I'm hearing eight different bins. But let's see if how our colleagues feel about that.
Just to ask a question, you know, why don't we have a cap on what they can charge? I remember last year when we – it was about this time last year we were hearing this, and, you know, of course, the issue of gas prices was the issue. I mean, gas is, you know, half of what it was last year, but prices have stayed up. You know, per some of the testimony we heard today. So, you know, if prices go up when gas goes up, that was the reason, you know, I heard last year, well, gas has come down. So why haven't prices come down? So, you know, if we're not going to introduce competition, then do we have a cap? And if the providers don't like that cap, then we can open it up to more competition. But there has to be some way to protect homeowners, particularly, you know, in these smaller units where they're literally at the mercy of these haulers because there is no competition. And, you know, there's really very little remedy. They have to just eat it. There's nothing they can do. So we either, you know, impose some kind of caps or we open up the competition or we ask for more transparency on how they price these things.
What was a recommendation of the number of franchise, a minimum of three, right?
Yes, sir. The recommendation we came back to you was to have a minimum of three, and one of them could be a smaller local business to provide additional competition. But yes, three.
So to the attorney, what can we do, and maybe you don't have an answer today, maybe we need to work on this, but what can we do to ensure that we would always have three? So let's say we have three, and then one gets bought out, and then we're back down to two, which is not a situation I want, because I think the more haulers we have, the better competition, the better pricing. So what could we do? Could we structure it to say that if one drops out, that would immediately trigger an RFP for a third one to be added back, or how could we deal with that issue?
If somebody drops off and the contract is either terminated, because you could have an anti-assignment clause in your contract that would prohibit assignments and make it a breach of a contract if an assignment occurred. But then the commission would always have the discretion to, at any point in time, open up an RFQ process to add an additional waste provider. At that time, you could also then there could be different options with an assignment clause to have an assignment with commission approval or you know under certain criteria. There we can look into it and talk to you further about that.
And what to Commissioner Areola's question about a cap? Can we if we were to have three contracts awarded? And maybe this is a question for Mr. Gomez or the city manager. Can you have a cap? My concern with that is that then all three may just gravitate towards the cap, and that might be some.
Right. I think that, you know, the competition is important, and I think it's an industry that's changing, and I think that hauling costs are going to change for every company that does business in this community. So I think a cap is really hard to define. The only other comment I would make, and I don't know if this is a crazy idea, Rafael, so if it is, tell me to stop, on the award of the contract and guaranteeing a third option, is it possible to award an alternate that would be part of the contract? And if we should have a company drop out, then we would have an alternate that would be available to replace.
We do that in construction and in different contexts for, you know, different tertiary, like you can have a primary vendor, a secondary, a tertiary vendor, and have options. That is an option. But in terms of the cap, I understand that we've discussed this with Public Works and that it would be very difficult in a competitive market or framework, rather, to establish a fixed fee for a portion of that market. And
the best way to do it would be to do it through for example, in the current residential contract, which is price structured because it was selected based on pricing, where then you can establish fixed prices for the 9 to 24, for example, or what that range would be. But under the franchise assignment, that I just don't see how you can do that, because you're mixing pricing with a franchise agreement, which is too.
And how did you get to the recommendation on 3 as opposed to 4? Was that just a question of how many different trucks?
We did think about it, Mr. Chair, and one of the issues obviously is traffic. You know, the city has a very defined grid system. The more haulers you introduce, the more traffic you're going to have, the more of these vehicles going through the city. And as we know, we're dealing with traffic issues all the time. So 3 we thought was and if you recall, the last go-around, the city did select 3. One ended up being acquired by one of the two, but we did select 3. So I think 3 is a good number. It provides good competition.
And have you thought about having districts and having to the north and a district to the south?
We've talked about that, too, about looking at the city from a geographic perspective as well.
So I want to talk about the 8 because I know that's your item, and I'm not wild about it, but I want you to have a chance to convince me otherwise.
Well, from my perspective, it was more about cost. These are residents who are absorbing these costs. I like what Commissioner Riola mentioned in terms of a cap. I mean, we've heard of our residents, their consumers, that get hit with a 100% increase in their fees, and it really is quite absurd and unreasonable to our residents if we could cap the percentage that it could go up on an annual basis. I think that's not unreasonable. I know in other contracts also, for example, when we're talking about gas prices, for example, you know, we've had other contracts in the city that we've considered and we've contemplated. Well, I think it was our towing contract, actually, that if, you know, depending on the price of gasoline, you know, then you can consider a certain percentage that increase, you know, depending on the price of gasoline. But I like what Commissioner Riola suggested in terms of a cap so that we can limit that. And the other thing, you know, I get the issue of traffic. I mainly see these garbage pickups happening in the morning, early morning, quite early in the morning when we don't have traffic.
I don't see them.
In
I hear
city.
Them. Beep, beep. Right. I get it.
Exactly. You get out of your window
in the morning.
Yes. It's not happening at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon when we experience gridlock in our city. These collections happen earlier in the day when we really don't have that much traffic in the city. And so the argument about traffic, I don't know, really, it's not convincing to me.
Okay. So here's what I want to do, because, you know, I like to move things along. We're going to bring this back next month. I would like staff to look at I like your idea, Madam Manager, about, so let's look at that, and let's look at, or how we can have contractually where, you know, they would be in breach. Let's explore those options. And Mr. Gomez, I would like you and the manager to go back and look at the 3 number, because I'm leaning more towards 4, but I'm usually to listen to the recommendation. And I'd like you to work with Commissioner Arriola and Commissioner Fernandez on the cap. And as Commissioner Fernandez said, maybe it's not a cap, a numerical cap, but a percentage escalation fee every year that would be capped. And I would encourage you to talk to the waste hauler so that you can get input from them on this. And we will hear this back in March. And just so everyone's on notice, you all had your chance today for public comment, so I will not be opening up for public comment next month. And next month, we're going to move this out and back to the commission one way or the other. And with that, I would just ask one other question, and that is, do you have an RFP drafted yet?
an RFQ for the commercial.
RFQ.
I think we started a draft, but we don't have a complete yet, sir.
Okay, so. I would encourage staff to start working on that.
Okay.
Because I think your waste month-to-month is up at the end of the fiscal year, is that right?
September 30th, yes, sir.
So if we need...
You may need
another month or two. The body has been willing to give you that. Is that okay, members? Okay, well, we'll bring this back and then be prepared with the items, and we're going to get this out next month, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your help. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. With that, we have an 11:30 time certain on the Homeless Trust. If Alba is here, and I think the Trust was going to try to call in as well. If you're leaving, please leave quietly so we can continue to conduct business. Good morning again. Good to see you. So we have two items. We've got item 11 and item 12 that we're calling together, and that is a discussion about the status of the interlocal agreement between the Miami Beach and the Homeless Trust, and also I want to talk about additional funding. As we all know, the original request was for $3 million, and as finance chair, I could only recommend funding $1 million when we did because we didn't have the cash flow, and so I want to talk about that because I think we may have an opportunity to provide some additional funding. So with that, Alba, tell us where we're at.
So we have been working with the Homeless Trust in building a strong MOU. Thus far, we have agreed on benchmarks such as income growth and housing retention. We have also requested 10 out of the 55 units from the allocation be at Mia Casa to address proximity as well as the elderly, as we know that we have seen an influx of the elderly population within our homeless system. We continue to work on timelines and payment structure. Just yesterday, we had a very productive meeting with the Homeless Trust, as well as the county attorneys and our attorney. The draft MOU is currently being reviewed by them. I'm sure we expect for Blue Village, which is one of the properties that they've designated for the additional the other 45 units, will have a rehab time of about a year or so. So they're in the permitting stages right now. So we'll have a better, more accurate timeline once that is phased
out. Where are we with the interlocal agreement, the MOU? What's the status? Is it in our court? Where is that?
We're in the draft form. Right now, their county attorney is reviewing it.
The county attorney?
Their county attorney, correct.
Okay. Have we reviewed it yet?
We have the attorney that's working with us, Ricardo DePico. He has it. We're getting the comments first from the county since we're the ones who drafted it and put all of the information in. Now the county attorney is taking a look at it, just making sure that everything is to their process and meets everything before we form approve it on our end.
Yeah. And does everyone understand that these 55 units, we're not getting that for $1 million. It was an ask for additional funding. So because I want to be clear on that, but that – you know, if we provide additional funding, it's not like we're going to get more units because it was an original funding request. Do you understand that?
As far as funding in...
No, I'm asking the question because someone said to me, oh, if we give you another $1 million, do we get another 55 units? And the answer is no. The original request was for three, and there may be a request in future years. It's just that I could not... recommend more than $1 million at the time when we did that in September just because I didn't have the cash flow in my budget. So is anyone online from the trust either?
No one has their hand raised. If you're with the Homeless Trust, could you please raise your hand on Zoom? Nope, no one.
If I may, Mr.
Chair. Go ahead.
Raquel Williams, Assistant City Manager. So we have drafted the MOU based on the discussion that has happened at previous meetings where the 55 units were proffered by the Homeless Trust, and therefore that's why those 55 units are included as part of the MOU. So Alba, if you'd like to explain the process by which we would be able to utilize those 55 units.
So the 45 units at Blue Village would not be available until the rehab is completed. I understand that they are looking to phase the rehabilitation. The 10 units would be based on attrition at Mia. The 10 beds would be based on attrition at Mia Casa, based on availability. So once we would send the referral, so let's say we have the units available, we would send the referral of a client. The client would have to agree. If not, those they would have a 14-day period before the unit would be available back to the homeless trust to be able to utilize for somebody else.
Kathy, one of the, you know, back in September when we allocated the $1 million, that's all we could really, in my view, afford in terms of cash flow at the time. But I know you were going to do a true-up of the first 3 or 4 months, the first quarter, and I was hoping that we were going to have additional funds when we compare our actuals versus budget. So has that been done?
Yes, Commissioner, and that LTC went out, I believe, beginning of last week, or if not the week before, and what we had projected in there was in the general fund having approximately an $8 million surplus by the end of the year, and in the resort tax fund, about $2 million. Of those $8 million in the general fund, there is an agenda item for a budget amendment related to ongoing projects, and about $3 million of that $8 million we are recommending for appropriation. The administration recommendation would be, number one, it's a little bit early with only the first quarter available. We'd like to see more trends before we start utilizing some of that money, and we would recommend that should the committee and the commission wish to provide the additional $1 million in funding that you have referred, that it go through the FY24 budget process, because we're about to do that in the next couple of months. We wouldn't have to wait till we got to September necessarily, but that way it'd be evaluated in comprehensively with all the other enhancements and initiatives that the commission is looking at.
But right now, we're estimating for the entire fiscal year, it looks like we're on track for about $8 million. That could change, of course, right?
Correct.
But we've got an additional $3 million already that we need to fill. So if we stay on track, we've got about five.
About five and about two in the resort tax.
Yeah. And can any of the resort tax be used for this, or it has to come out of the general fund?
No, I think the resort tax could be used for it because a lot of our homeless are not from Miami Beach.
Yeah.
And it is, we have treated homelessness in the past, our services for the homeless in the past as a resort tax eligible activity.
Okay. So, and I want to hear from my colleagues, but I would be in favor of moving it back with a recommendation that $500,000 from resort tax and $500,000 from general, because I really feel like we need to be a participant in this. My fear is that if we don't get ahead of this, we're going to have a situation like we're seeing on the West Coast, and it's not something that we want to see. I think our population is still under 200, and it's a very manageable number, although it's an issue that we hear about quite often, at least I do. But I would like to hear from my colleagues on this. You're recognized. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is, I supported the $1 million when it came to commission last year, because as you mentioned, this is important. We need to be proactive, and we need to be ahead. I get concerned of what the future may bring in terms of homelessness, and certainly we don't want to see what we're seeing in the West Coast over here. I recall that when Mr. Book came and he asked us for this support, he said that the advantage of doing of purchasing these buildings is that it would be immediate inventory that would be available. Right now, these buildings have been purchased by the Homeless Trust. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is that inventory available right now?
Not the inventory at Blue Village, but we continue to send referrals to the Homeless Trust whenever we have clients. But the actual locations of Blue Village is not available right now. But Mia Casa is, And for Mia Casa specifically, we do refer clients there, even without the agreement, right. So I'll make mention of that. But it's a process based on attrition. So the person would have to leave in order for that bed to become available.
And with Blue Village, what's going on with Blue Village right now?
Blue Village, they're in the permitting process, I believe, to the best of my knowledge. And so they have already purchased the property. They have identified a contractor that would work the property, but they're in the permitting stages of the rehabilitation.
And when you say they, who is they?
The Homeless Trust.
So the county?
The county.
So this is the county is engaging in a construction project. All right.
Yes.
This is my concern. I came from the county, and I think we are all familiar sometimes when government engages in construction, it's not always the quickest process. It's usually never within the schedule that they think it's going to be in, and usually they encounter cost overruns and that type of stuff.
And my apologies, I'm very sorry. They're in plan and development, not in the permitting stage.
So they're not in permitting yet.
They're in plan and development.
Planning and development. This is the concern that I have. Because I was very excited to support this when it came to us, because the idea that we would have, you know, be purchasing a building, we wouldn't have to go through the process of construction. This is what was sold to me at that podium. That we would be buying already built units that would be turnkey, and I think the word turnkey was the term turnkey was used. Until I see us more ahead in that process, I can't support giving this more money. And I'm sorry to say that, because I didn't realize that this would be a construction process. That the county would be engaging in not only buying buildings, but engaging in construction, that it wouldn't be immediate space that would be available for us. Once they've gone ahead and they've closed permits or they got a CO, then I'd be open to give them more money. But I just know how this goes with the county. They're a governmental entity like we are, and we're not always the best and most efficient in going into these construction projects. So I certainly 100% support us going forward and providing direction to the administration to finalize negotiations on the MOU with the proper benchmarks on occupancy and housing retention and income growth. I think that's very important. Mm-hmm. But equally important is the delivery of those units. And once these buildings have gone through their permitting, construction, and they have a certificate of use, at that point that these units become available, will I feel a little bit more comfortable in adding more money to this? But what was sold to me here is that we were buying built units that would be turnkey and addressing the issue immediately. I would imagine that if they're in the planning and development process, this... What's their projection to have a CU?
What they've shared with us is about a year.
So
for us, on this $1 million in the agreement, to address your concern, Commissioner, one of the things that we're looking at is the payment structure. A 50% in the beginning, once the execution of the agreement, and potentially 50% after the CO, the certificate of completion, is received for this particular $1 million.
The project that Commissioner Fernandez mentioned is that is... It's a renovation of an existing building?
Yes, that is what we would be funding, which is the Blue Village, which is the Chrome site. And so that location would be what's undergoing rehabilitation. I just received a text message from Vicky that unfortunately she's stuck in traffic. I'm sure that she wanted to join us. So.
Okay. Commissioner Arreola.
Yeah. Commissioner Richardson, did you say you support the $1 million, half a million?
I support, we've done $1 million, I support another $1 million, I think we have it, and I would pay for that half with resort taxes and half with...
Do you need me to make a motion on that?
Yes.
Okay, I'll make a motion on that so we can move for the full commission to discuss. And look, Commissioner Fernandez, I share your global sentiment about the speed of government and, you know, how things get bogged down, so... That point is not lost on me. It's just this issue is, I think, critical. And, you know, if Mr. Book were here, and why I want to move to the full commission is, you know, hopefully he can call in or come in to explain exactly where things stand and hopefully satisfy your concerns. But they do need the money. It's a significant amount of money that we need to continue to address our homeless situation. But if we don't fund it, it will get worse and then ultimately more expensive at, you know, tragic cost of human life and quality of life for those affected by homelessness and their families as well as the surrounding community. So we just have to commit the resources to one day eliminate it completely, but at the very, very minimum mitigate it. When you look at Chicago, D.C., New York, San Francisco, L.A., they're horrific. I fear that they're at the point of no return, much because of the policies of those cities. They actually have a lot of money. Some have billions of dollars committed to this, but their homeless situation is also due to just a lot of policies around, you know, permissive drug use, allowing for, tent cities to be erected, not vacating them, not enforcing laws, cashless bail programs. There's a litany of policy errors that many administrations have made, and, you know, you've got situations like Skid Row in Los Angeles that have, you know, some estimates 70,000 people living on the streets in an 8-square block area. You can't fix that anymore. It's
horrible.
It's horrific. And so I want to make sure that we in the county and every participating city continues to contribute reasonable resources so that we never, ever find ourselves in that situation.
Okay, so, and they, I totally get your point, but they may need the money just to fund renovations and so forth.
I got that.
With the MOU, did the commission give you authority to the administration authority to execute that without us? No.
No. Okay. In the December meeting, the conversation was to bring it back to finance for a discussion, as well as there is an item in neighborhoods. The plan is after those items pass, the form approved MOU would go to our full city commission. It would then have to go to the Homeless Trust Board, as well as their commission committee, and finally the BCC, the Board of County Commissioners.
When is that going to be ready? Because I want to move this along. So, Raquel, can I move that? Can we just move that back to the commission without a final approval on the words of the MOU today and have the commission deal with it?
I just want to confirm with our CFO, but if the intent is to add an additional $1 million, I think the commission would need to weigh in on that allocation for us to then move forward with negotiating the MOU to include $2 million as opposed to the $1 million that was already
I wasn't even aware, quite frankly, that there was a dollar amount in the MOU. I'm not sure I'm in agreement with that, because it would be a mistake for anyone to think that we're getting 55 units for $1 million. That was never an ask, and it was never what we agreed on. We provided some funding, and they agreed to some housing. But, I'm a little bit concerned about that, Commissioner.
Let me ask a question. In the MOU, I think ultimately it seems like it may be ultimately the desire to allocate up to $3 million, but perhaps as part of the MOU we can set benchmarks, including construction benchmarks, so that as their construction advances, we can make funds available, you know, of course, based on whether we have the funds in our budget. But, you know, okay, they pass a planning development phase, and they're in the permitting process. Okay, well, then we can release a certain amount of funds. And as this progresses, you know, be releasing more and more funds.
I think that's a really good idea.
And, Commissioner, I think the Homeless Trust is going to want to see the funding in the agreement.
And I believe that Mr. Book, as well as Victoria Mallett, are in the Zoom waiting room.
Okay. Okay. So if Ms. Mallett or Mr. Book are in there,
Mr. Chair, I just want to put for the record, just because I got to leave by 11:55. Just
okay. And I want to, we've got a couple other items. So let's do this. I think we've got some, there's been a motion, it's been seconded. We're going to move back to commission. I want to move this agreement back to the commission as well, and we'll let the commission deal with the wording on that.
And would you like that, do you accept that amendment or that suggestion that I offered on benchmarks?
Yes, so let's get staff to look at that on benchmarks. I think that's an excellent suggestion. And let's send that back to the commission. Is that okay with you all? And the additional funding. And I will circle back with you on, because it's my goal that we achieve $3 million this fiscal year. It's just that I can't put it all on the table right now. So with that, that's what we're going to do. Everybody know what we're doing?
I just want to clarify on the number of units and beds. I think we do have to incorporate that into the MOU just for clarity.
I'm not opposed to that. It's just that I want to be clear to everybody that it was never intended that we would get 55 beds for $1 million. That was, and if anyone is under that impression or understanding, it's not accurate. I never believed that if we could do that, I'll put up $1 million more. But that's not the intention. But we'll continue working on that. So we know what we're doing on this item, and we'll move forward. Now, I want to call up. Item 13 and 17, they're somewhat related. I have an item on technology and parking operations, and also we've been looking at this issue on the handicap placards, which has been a real issue in the city. And so I've spent a lot of time working on this as well. I know that we've got a vendor that is offering to do a pilot program for free, which I'm very excited about. And I think that we can work on two things at one time. You've got this item on disability. I think that this city has got to get a handle on the disability placard abuse. So I just heard from Monica yesterday. They went to the 46th Street surface parking lot. There are 450 spaces. They counted 196 handicap placards. We know what's happening, right? The workers are those hotels are using those spaces. We've got, and there are a number of things that we can do, and we can do time limits and so forth, and those are things. But I would like to hear, Mr. Andrade is here. I think he's representing a company that is willing to do some data collection with this new technology, and I'm very excited about that. And Mr. Andrade, you're recognized to tell us exactly what you think you can do, and please include the word free and at no cost to the city government.
Sure. Good morning, committee members and everyone else. Ralph Andrade. I represent Edico Parking Solutions. With me is Fred Breedemeyer. I had a short video presentation, but since Commissioner Fernandez I guess you've got to leave, so we can skip that. It'll take a couple of minutes. So I'm just going to turn it over to him and let him explain what it does. I think I've explained it to you all. The only thing that I would say is that the scope of the lots where you install the cameras, I think, should be 5 as opposed to 3 so that you can get an accurate reading. 3 of the lots that I think have been identified are primarily in commercial areas, which is the Lincoln Lane lot, the 46th Street lot, and the lot across the street from the Bandshell. You also have lots in residential areas, which I think are not typically enforced. And so if you want to get an accurate reading, I think you should include 2 residential lots. So 3 lots in your commercial corridors and 2 lots in your residential
areas. Okay, let's go ahead and tell us who you are and what you do. And we're going to be brief because Commissioner Fernandez has got a schedule and we're going to keep him on a schedule. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, City Commission. My name is Fred Breedemeyer. I'm the CEO of Pave Mobility, and Pave Mobility is headquartered in Dania Beach, Florida, and in the Design Center of the Americas, where we employ a couple of dozen people that provide parking technology solutions. And we provide specifically license plate recognition solutions, where we identify vehicles going in and out of parking lots with license plate recognition. I've been involved in the South Florida parking community for 30 years or more. I've managed a lot of municipal parking around the country. I was COO of the Miami Parking Authority for 5 years. I've managed parking here on Miami.
I'm going to help you, okay? So it's my understanding that you're willing to install cameras in up to 5 parking lots at no cost to the city for minimum of 3 months, maximum of 6 months. You're willing to do data collection and share all that data collection with us, your system's interface with the parking apps, right?
Correct.
So we will be able to know how many people are paying. I am not in favor, members, of doing any citations during this study period. I want to figure out how much revenue we're losing. Have I captured it?
100%.
Okay, so I'd like one of you to move it, if you will. Let's send it back to the commission to accept that.
Yeah, so I'm fully supportive of this. I just, you know, learned of this, and I loved it the minute I heard about it. Just to be clear, are we supporting 3 or the 5?
So I like the idea of 3, but I do get the point that there may be some benefit in looking at 2 residential. So I would say, let's say up to 5, and before it gets to the commission, we can chat and figure out the benefit of whether or not these 2, and then we can make a final decision there. But no more than 5, completely no cost to the city. You'll share all data, because I want to see how much revenue. And also, I want to keep the rest of the item here in that looking at the revenue stream, because I believe we're leaving a lot of revenue on the table. And if it means we need to hire more enforcement officers, I'm open to looking at that. And then the other thing I'd like to keep, Commissioner Fernandez, during this six-month period, we have to take a serious look at this disability issue and figure out. I think I've been told there are things we can do. We can maybe add hour restrictions.
That's right.
And, you know, so if with that particular parking lot, if we had a 4-hour or 6-hour limit, all those people that are working 8 hours would not be able to, and parking could also, you know, you get one in and one out. So is that okay if we do that?
Yeah. So I'm leaning just on the issue of, you know, the expanded program towards the 5 and to include a couple residential areas. And, you know, I'll, at the full commission, I'll sort of spend time explaining why. But I actually love this and was happy to see this.
So if you that's your motion, I'll second it. So we will do 5 and 2 residential yet to be decided. And, Monica, you will help us with those. And with that, we'll move it to the full commission in March to be heard. We're keeping the item here, Kathy, my item 13, because I want to continue talking about loss of revenue and ways that we can, and we're also keeping 17, and we're going to work on the disability issue. Commissioner Fernandez.
Right, and on number 17, what I would like to see is for staff to come back with a recommendation, because right now right now, we know who are abusing these placards. They're employees of it's a workforce of these hotels and different businesses. In part, by the way, because the property owners, the hotels, are not letting them park on the parking that they've had to construct that we require in our minimum parking requirements. The hotels are not letting them park there, and so. And so I would like for staff to come back with a recommendation on a registration, some sort of registration that if you have a handicap placard, you can have more than the 4 hours more that you're allowed to have for free, so that if you register with the city, you show your prescription for your handicap placard and you register that with the city, then now you can have more than the 4 hours free. That way we can hopefully identify which are the ones that are being abused and fabricated. Because that's ultimately the problem. There's an organized crime out there of individuals who are selling and fabricating prescriptions and fabricating these prescriptions for these placards. If we now establish a registration requirement for anything beyond the 4 hours, we may perhaps be able to crack down on this. So I just want staff to kind of explore it and see if they could put together some sort of suggestion for that.
Can I just add one thing?
Go ahead.
And to your point, Commissioner, the sooner you do that, the better, because if we establish it's going to be a 4-hour free time limit on your surface lots,
And thereafter, you have to register in order to stay longer for free. We can integrate that into the program, and the data you're getting becomes even more accurate. So, you know, you've hit the nail right on the head. My understanding from speaking with the city attorney is that you can impose these time limits, and after the time limits expire, if the person wants to stay for free, you can require them to upload their permit information, and we can do that all on site. They don't have to go anywhere. It's an on-site registration right there when they park. And lastly, if we happen to tag someone with a legitimate, you know, disabled parking permit, you know, the worst thing is they just mail in evidence of their permit, and you void the violation. So, you know, it's really no harm, no foul.
Okay, so Monica, your priority for the March meeting is to come with suggestions to address Commissioner Fernandez's item 17. My item 13, half of it's going to stay here, and we'll put that in April, so you won't have to bring both back, okay? So your priority is, and I agree, we got to get whatever we're going to do, we need to get it done and then send something back to the commission for consideration. So, all right, with that, I know you've got to go.
And thank Mr. you. Mr. Chair, if I could just get clarity of what you're moving out to commission is a pilot to work with PAVE Mobility, the organization, to access certain city lots at no cost to the city. With no obligation on the city's part to permit them to test their technology and share information with you so that you could then decide what, if any, changes you want to make to how you operate the parking system.
And the sharing of the data is obligatory on their part, not non-voluntary. So they would be required to share the data with us as part of the agreement so that we have all that data and we can better determine how much revenue we're leaving on the table.
And the city, of course, has to share its data from its payment sources so that we can make the connection as to who's paid and who hasn't. Correct.
Understood. Yeah. So we'll roll that into a license agreement to access the properties and memorialize the data.
They'll be responsible for all the equipment cost and installation cost and all that.
And integrations, yes.
Okay.
And just, you know, an ask of our staff to help with permits and everything they need to get this up and so it doesn't get slow danced. And we're here
that's
a year and a
really
night
good. That's a good. So
thank you.
I didn't think about that, but that's a really
good. I mean, you know, the deep state doesn't only exist at the federal level.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Okay, everybody, you got what you need?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
You're going to miss it, but we're going to talk about iguanas. But that's okay.
Are you doing that now?
Yeah. Yeah. But I know you got to go.
I got to do a big five.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Iguana Masters. This is item number 10. Adrian, thank you for your patience.
No worries.
And so we won't spend that much time on it, but just tell us where we're at with iguana remediation and how much money we've funded, remind me, and how much money we've spent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and Commissioner. Good morning. Adrian Morales, Facilities Director, for the record. So this item, you know, requested the administration work on putting together an RFQ for iguana removal services and establishing an ad hoc committee, which we've been working with for the last few months. The RFQ for iguana removal services just came back. It's still under the cone of silence, so we're in the process of reviewing those proposals. This city commission funded $200,000 enhancement to be able to remove iguanas on public property last fiscal year. We've spent about $115,000 in the first few months of this year. You know, we hit the ground running. You know, we removed about 1,000 iguanas a week at some point in time, and about 3,300, give or take, you know, prior to the end of the calendar year. And we've been working with the ad hoc committee to try to, you know, establish some of the programs and some of the things that we you know, want to do. We heard the residents, you know, for example, one of the suggestions that came from that committee was to discuss a bounty program. We've been in contact with Fish and Wildlife. We've been in contact with all of our neighboring communities at the request of this, you know, sponsored item. So we've done a lot of work. You know, we spent a lot of time and a lot of detail trying to get this together. And what we know is that the $200,000 allocation doesn't seem like it's going to be enough based on the burn rate. We don't know what that number is going to be because we don't have final contracts. We don't have direction if we're going to start going into private property and what the fiscal impact of that is going to be. We don't know what the bounty is going to look like. The Cayman Islands, spent about $9 million for their program. A lot of logistical issues, a lot of other type problems that came about from that. They paid for it from a departure tax that they were able to collect from tourism. Some of the suggestions from the ad hoc committee is to establish some type of tax to fund this. So we don't know. Again, there's a lot of work that's going into this. Fish and Wildlife has told us they do not support a bounty. They think it's going to bring other type problems for us. And there are a lot of details.
State Fish and Wildlife?
No. Florida Fish and Wildlife has suggested against a bounty program. And a lot of our neighboring communities don't have the problems we have. We've been in contact with the county. We've been in contact with Surfside. We've been in contact with North Bay Village, Miami, everyone near, the waterways to try to see, and they just don't have evidence of major issues. But we do have an issue. We do have problems with iguanas. We have identified areas where we can go in there, and we've been working closely with Rafael and his team on the entry into private property, if that so is the will of the body. But there are challenges with that. Are we indemnifying contractors if they create damage? Are we subsidizing that? All of those details are still being worked on. So at some point during this budget process, we'd like to come back with a comprehensive plan and let you folks decide what you want us to do.
Commissioner Fernandez.
Yeah, I think we if you need more funding for this fiscal year before next fiscal year, I think we should encourage them to come back to commission with that without having to come back through the committee process. My understanding is that this has been an incredibly successful program. It seems like unlike our other neighbors, it seems like, from what I gather, and from where you've gathered the most iguanas, that the main challenges are our golf courses, that perhaps could be the bigger breeding ground for this. Perhaps some of our other neighbors don't have as much open green space as we do. And so we kind of know what could be the source of the issue. So, Mr. Chair, I would, and Commissioner Riola, I would encourage that we support the administration, that if they do need additional money for this contract, that they do come back to commission for that. Additionally, I do think we should encourage these companies that if they're doing work with the city, that they do offer a discount for Miami Beach homeowners that may need iguana removal from their property. So if somehow we could incorporate that. I know that some companies have offered up to a 40% discount towards iguana removal for Miami Beach residents, and I'd like to see that integrated in anything that we approve.
Mr. Chair, if I could add for the record, so we've been working on this removal service or program under an emergency purchase authority, and we have multiple contractors. We have 6 dedicated personnel throughout the city. In different areas, specifically golf courses. We have a crew that's on the golf course. We have people in South Beach, North Beach, Mid Beach, in the waterway. So, again, it's ongoing. It's evolving. I think we've been successful to some extent. I think there's a lot of more work that needs to be done, and I think that we're going to get there.
Yeah, so I think if you had 200 and you've already spent over 130, clearly we're going to need more money, and I don't want to wait until we run out of money. So if somebody wants to make a motion to increase the funding, I think another $200,000 at a minimum we need in this fiscal. So, Kathy, if you'll prepare that, we'll send that back to the commission for approval, because I don't want to wait till we run out of money and then have to do it. So we'll recommend an additional $200,000, and that's it. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Excellent. Thank you, guys.
All right.
All right, guys.
Okay, we've got the item 4 on update on economic development. This is on the permitting process. Mr. Book.
Mr. Chair, I'm aware didn't know the boat truck show traffic was across. I simply wanted to come and say thank you.
You're welcome. The item is going to be heard in commission on March 27th,
And so if you're not available, if you could have your staff available in person, that would be helpful. Okay?
On the 27th, do you all allow Zoom stuff anymore at all?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll be in Tallahassee.
Yeah.
You want me in Tallahassee, not here. So
we do.
That would be okay. Thank you.
We do.
Yeah, that's
nice
a
see,
commission
nice
meeting.
Seeing you. Thanks for coming in. We didn't know.
Yeah,
thanks.
And we'll try to get a time certain so that, you know, you'll know when it'll be heard, okay?
Thank you, and I won't have boat your traffic
coming. Okay, great. Thank you for coming. Thanks so much.
And by the way, Vicky's was parking as well. We just didn't want to be disrespectful.
Didn't know you were on your way.
Yeah,
save you the effort.
She took 395. I assure you there was no difference.
Yeah. Well, while you're here, if you're interested in a boat, there's a boat show going on.
I was going to go with that one that was $358 million I saw in the newspaper.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you, Mr. Book. Item number four is on the permitting process, and then after that we'll take up item 14, which is my item on the ombudsman. So go ahead. Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Great to be on.
Good afternoon.
I'll tee it up, and I was going to ask you if you could take it with 14, because
yeah.
maybe that's
yeah.
the solution, which you know, I'll just sort of give an editorial, which I've given before on this issue, which is, you know, particularly with businesses and as we try to attract new businesses and, you know, be more proactive in attracting businesses and trying to continue to stimulate our economy and economic diversification, you know, I don't want our permitting process to be an obstacle that keeps businesses away, so I'm curious to know what we can do to expedite the permitting process, make it more transparent, reduce costs, et cetera. And I know that staff has been working really hard on this, and then I think you have a great idea, Commissioner Richardson, on potentially having
ombudsman.
I can never say that word.
That's okay.
But anyway, I think having a you know, a point person who is in charge of permits might be the solution.
Right. So, good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
What say you about an ombudsman? And I was specifically thinking about, you know, for residents, but it doesn't have to be limited to that. It could be for businesses as well. You know, when I say we're, my age spends a lot of time taking calls from residents that get permits that are just stuck. And so my idea is to have someone outside of the building department. Really what happened a couple of months ago, I didn't even realize, but he was working on trying to get something moving, and it was four different departments because there was an environmental piece and there was a building. So it was four different departments, and they weren't talking to each other, so then he was having to talk to all of them and put it together. And I think if we have an ombudsman that is outside of the building department that was responsible for coordinating with, you know, anyone that would be involved, it might be helpful. So with that, I'll let you tell me if you think we can work through that or if it's an awful idea.
Sure. No, it's definitely not an awful idea. I think that our economic development group is doing an excellent job of handholding the new businesses that are trying to come into the city and helping them kind of figure out some of the roadblocks. We reached out to Coral Gables, who has a similar position, and talked to them about, you know, what they've been doing, what they've been seeing. And we do think that there might be an opportunity here to have someone. We would like to see it be more resident-focused, because we do think that there's probably a communication gap between the residents that are not as familiar with the process and the challenges that are overcome there. So we see this as a position that would be in the manager's office, would be someone that interfaces with the mayor and commission when they get phone calls and are contacted, but also has office hours and would accept, you know, walk-in clientele for people that are frustrated or have issues that, or just want to find out what it would take to start the process. I think all of that makes sense.
Commissioner Ariola.
Yeah, my one comment there would be I wouldn't want this to report into the city manager. I think it's a conflict of interest, right? Because he or she would be reporting into their boss, who's also responsible ultimately for the permitting process. So I think we'll just add a layer of bureaucracy and cost. You know, I don't know what the solution is, but maybe this person reports into the office of the mayor and the city commission. You know, either you know, dual reporting or dotted line, so that when we hear complaint, imagine, right? So he or she hears complaints from a business, permitting process, the person then goes to the city manager saying we're having delays. You know, like you're whistleblowing on yourself. I think that's a conflict of interest. So if we were to create a position, I would want them to report to you know, the city commission and the mayor. Or some other office, you know, the IG, not the city attorney. I don't know that that's appropriate, but it would have to be somebody where the lines don't cross.
Yeah, it's a point well taken. And I mean, I was initially thinking of move. I didn't want it in the building department, but all these departments still report to the city manager. I mean, right now, what's happening is my aide and your aide and all the aides are spending a lot of time on this, and so I'm looking for a process that when we get a call, we can say, oh, we've got a person dedicated to dealing with that. And so maybe it is a person in the mayor's office that reports and is outside of the city administration. I don't know. We probably are springing that on you. I don't know if you have a thought about that.
I think that it brings with it its own challenges. Would like to think about that a little bit more. Not saying that it couldn't work, but it does create some issues, because then it's outside the chain of command, and it's also outside of the ability to potentially tap into some resources that are in the manager's office that I think would be helpful.
I mean, look, my experience when we get issues of permits, and look, sometimes it is not at all the city's fault or responsibility. It does lie with the person applying for the permit. But my experience has been when somebody brings us an issue, it does get resolved fairly quickly by staff. But the issue is, you know, residents and businesses shouldn't have to be coming to us for these kinds of things. They should be able to get answers quickly and remedy quickly from the city, and sometimes that's not happening for whatever reason. And, you know, if it's coming from commission or the mayor, things tend to get resolved fairly quickly. So that's my observation and experience. It's not just this city. I work outside the city in private industry, and when I have to get a permit from any city, it is a really painful, mysterious process. And typically, if it gets really delayed, I'll have to make a phone call to a elected official or, you know, a high-level government employee that I might know, and miraculously it gets resolved. I get an answer. Government shouldn't have to work that way, because if you file for a permit, like I have one under Rao right now, it's been sitting there for 2 months. Fine, 2 months is reasonable. Yeah. But 3, 4, 5 months for a routine renovation should not – that's not business friendly. That's not, from a policy matter, what we want to do as a city. So then I have to call somebody. That's not the way government should function. It exists everywhere. I don't want that to exist in Miami Beach. I want Miami Beach to be the most business-friendly, the most resident-friendly, that we can turn around things within a reasonable time. Doesn't mean, you know, somebody files a permit and they expect an answer within a week, which we all get. I'll get that from a friend, and I'm like, that's unreasonable. I'm not going to do anything, you know, until an appropriate amount of time has passed. Then, you know, we'll ask questions. But I think, you know, we need to be the best city in terms of turnaround and transparency. And I think we're really good. I don't want to misstate. We're really good. We can do better. And if having a dedicated resource to help residents and businesses get through the permitting process gets us there, then it's a good use of government resources to invest in that position.
Heather, with respect to the business on item 4, what exactly are we doing to help businesses with the permitting? Do we have someone dedicated in your department?
Heather Shaw, Assistant Director of Economic Development. We have an expedited plan review program for certain sectors of the community, and so we do have someone who tries to help the business navigate through the permitting process. And
is that on the front end, or is that like, if the permits get caught up, then you help out, or is that on the front end, just understanding the process?
They apply for the program, and these are financial services or tech companies that are new to the market, who are expanding or new to the market, and so we help them. And so it's a very narrow pool of people that we help, and we shepherd them. But we also have team members who are proactive and go out into the community and are talking with businesses to say, are you having any issues? Is there something that we can help you with? And our phones are always open to have one-to-one concierge services for any business that calls and they have any issues to try to help, you know, solve those issues. And if it involves navigating through, you know, some of our city departments, then we help them do that as well.
And but you don't have anyone dedicated to...
We have those tasks dedicated to staff, but they are not just doing that solely. Yeah. They have other things that they also work
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Do you know how many issues you have on a month or an annual basis that... I'm not talking about the upfront where you're trying to help people understand the process, but just when you're trying to get a permit unstuck, if you will. How often is that?
In our expedited plan review program, we have about 4 active companies that are in that process that we're working with.
But those are...
Through an application.
Yeah, but I'm talking about if a business has a problem with their permits, what do they do? Eric, do they call the building department or who... I'm sure. Trying to open up a new ice cream store and my permits are stuck. Who do I call?
So we actually have a dedicated group of individuals in the building department that help troubleshoot issues. I think the last I heard, they were taking between 300 and 400 calls on a weekly basis to handle things. Just so we've got some frame of reference, we're issuing about 1,000 permits a month, and our average from application to issuance on permits over the last 3 months was 75 days. Over the last calendar year was 94 days. So, I mean, we're doing a little bit better recently, but obviously we still know that we've got a ways to go. We want to be the best. We want people to come to Miami Beach because they know they can get answers and they can get their issues resolved. I do think that the departments are very responsive, whether an individual is getting asked by a member of the public, a member of the commission, or a member of the manager's office. I think in all of those instances, I've not heard very many instances of people saying that when I spoke to somebody, I didn't get an answer. They don't always like the answer.
It really raises the same question I was mentioning earlier about when I learned a couple of months ago that my aide was having to talk to 4 different departments on a residential permit. So, and a business permit could be the same thing. So if you've got people in the building department that are helping, but they're having to coordinate with other departments. So it may be something that we want to look at is having that type of person not in the building department, you know, but more
global.
Yeah, more global. And I don't know with the ombudsman, I can see some issues having it in the manager's office. I definitely don't want it in the building department, but, you know, maybe it belongs in the mayor's office. I don't know. I want to think about that a little bit. So I think I want to why don't we think about that issue and bring it back next month, Kathy, that that we you know what, Commissioner Ariola, if it's okay with you, I want to move the ombudsman back to the commission.
Yeah.
And then, because I think we've decided everything except for where it would be. How much the funding was around $100,000, I think, all inclusive, right?
Yeah, the position in Coral Gables is in the salary range of $62,000 to $90,000 annually. You know, if we're talking about the 62 range, then you'd be talking about $100,000 fully loaded.
Yeah, and if it's 120 and by the time we get there it's a half a year, it's a $60,000 hit on this particular budget. So let's send it back to the commission and then for the March 27th, and then we will decide by then where we want to recommend that the person be, if the commission is going to be fully supportive. Okay?
And just to be clear, this would be for all permits, residential and commercial?
Just residential, I think. And then what I want to do is revisit what we're doing on the business, because maybe we need to have a separate, right now that's in the building department, but maybe that needs also to be pulled out of building department, and maybe it needs to be another person dedicated, or maybe the a two-person department that handles both residential and business.
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, look, I'll make my pitch at the full commission that maybe this should be part of the Office of Mayor and Commission, because it is one of the calls we get the most about. And, you know, I think it's transparent. It avoids conflicts of interest, and they can provide us reports. I got this many requests. These were the timelines. These are the resolutions. You know, I think it'll work just fine. It basically commits the mayor's office as a resource to residents for something that they constantly call us about. Right. And they can give us, as a commission, an unbiased report. I had, you know, 200 requests from residents for permits. They were all closed out in 30 days, nothing to worry about. Or they could tell us the opposite. They are taking a little bit long, and, you know, there's some areas for improvement. And you don't have that conflict of interest where, you know, their boss is a person that, you know, reporting on.
Right. Yeah, because right now the work's being done in the mayor's office by our aides. It's just we don't have the time.
Visibility.
Yeah.
There's no one in our office that's compiling. You know, Eric will get half dozen requests or whatever each month. Yours will get the same. So collectively we might be getting 100 a month. I don't know. But we don't have that visibility because we don't collect that data and share it.
Exactly. So, and then, so we'll move this back to the commission with a recommendation on an ombudsman, and then before it's heard March 27th, we'll talk more about whether or not it's going to be residential and business, or because it may be, if it includes business, maybe we need two people, but maybe we have one person out of the building department that might be moved, or maybe we create a new slot. I don't know, but I'm leaning towards what Commissioner Ariola says, to have it in the mayor's office, which is where it's... We're really doing it right now. Our aides are. We just don't have the time. So,
if I could,
yes, please.
I think a critical piece of having this conversation and structuring this appropriately is to make sure that this individual, wherever they land, is someone that helps get things unstuck. Yes. I don't want to create the impression that this is a fast pass for people to circumvent the system, because then that creates other issues.
Yeah. To that point, I mean, we have people that call us that, you know, want us to do the fast pass or whatever, and we can't do that. We don't do that. I mean, we basically will help somebody if their permit is stuck. And quite frankly, half the time we find that it's stuck because they haven't done something they need to be doing, and it's not anything related to or the fault of our staff. So, yeah, I think that's... That's good. Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah. Eric, when you present this, make sure you emphasize that point, because we could need to make this very clear. If we were going to put this in the mayor's office, there's a good job description, and the residents don't think this is a fast pass, or that even staff feels somehow intimidated or bullied by this person. This is, you know, an unbiased referee who can help facilitate, you know, on both ends, things that get stuck, but not, you know, anything more than that. And really not even stuck. Sometimes this person can just help the person navigate our permitting process, help explain, you know, things that they may not know.
Yeah, and you mentioned Coral Gables has this now. So can we get a copy of whatever their job description is if we don't have it? And then, okay, great. So then
right here.
Why don't also, as part of this item, you all work on a draft job description, and, you know, we can decide where they're going to be placed. I think we're leaning towards the mayor's office right now. But let's come back with a job description as well, and then we'll Kathy will bring this back for March 27th, and you know, if it's a potential funding for a half a year of say $60,000, whatever, won't be quite that much, but I think that's where we're landing. And then if it passes commission, then we'll be including it in our full budget for the next time around. And then what I'd like to do is circle back around on the business piece as well. I'll give you guys a call and we can talk about that, because maybe it's really two people and that it'll be both residential and business. So I think that's what we should look at. Any other questions on this? Okay. With that, Commissioner Ariel, I think we've run out of time. There's item 15 that I'm not really sure why Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez, this is a $10,000. She could put that on consent, I suppose. But if she wants us to hear it here, if she comes next month, we'll do that. And we'll defer item 16, given that we're out of time. And with that, if there's nothing else, Kathy or Mr. Paz, Ricky, we'll stand adjourned. Oh, good. Thanks to everybody. Thank you.